This is Fanboy versus the summer 2015 special, or episode 153 for those who count, which is me. I'm Brian Kilby. With me, we have Nicole Hale, Chris Triplett, and Chris McFeely. Guys, take it away.
Hello?
Throw in the deep end there. We're very unpracticed at this. So, we're here to talk about this year's films and TV and such. Comics, no. We used to do them one time.
Yeah, but now comics don't actually get published anymore if you're DC Comics. Everything is a television and media now.
Just publishing comics? I don't know what happened to them.
I haven't bought a DC comic in months, so they must not be, you know?
Yeah, clearly. I mean, that's obviously, when you're not looking at it, it ceases to be, right? It's like, yeah. Like playing peekaboo with the baby. Yeah. I'm not looking at DC, so it's not there anymore.
Tiny Titans is still awesome.
Yes, always. And Multiversity is very good.
I will promote Tiny Titans until the day is officially dead.
I didn't know it came back.
Yep.
It did a miniseries last year, wow. Yeah.
Awesome.
Return to the Treehouse.
Mm-hmm. And it was awesome.
It was. Because, you know, I was starting to lose faith in Baltazar and Franco because I didn't think much of their itty-bitty Hellboy.
They did an itty-bitty Hellboy?
They did. I couldn't understand why it wasn't called Heckboy.
Oh, that's going to be great!
You know, they did Tiny Titans, and they did...
I would have been okay with Hell Lad also.
Gosh, there was something else they did, was it? Well, they have their own things that they do. Maybe there was just... They did Itty Bitty Mask for DC as well, or Dark Horse. But I decided not to pick that one up after I didn't think Itty Bitty Hellboy worked out very well. But as I said, I don't know why they didn't call it Heckboy.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
But whenever I heard they were doing Tiny Titans, it was really crap. Anyway, we're not here for comics.
A comic book show that does talk comics.
Yeah.
We'll maybe at the end of the show talk about some of the things we're reading at the minute, throw out some recommendations or anything.
Yeah,
but a lot of stuff happenings in film and TV this past year. And we'll start by talking about the biggest one, which was Age of Ultron, which is what, two, three weeks now?
Yep.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's
four for
$2.
You, I guess. Three for us. This
whatever,
is
add
yeah.
One, whatever, yeah.
That really sucked. Again, I stayed away from spoilers until like the last 3 hours when someone ruined some stuff for me, and I'm like, really?
I dropped off the internet for like 2 weeks.
The spoiler. So the spoiler from me came from someone on this call who said, and I paraphrase, I can't quote. It's like, just to save you the grief, the line didn't happen.
Yeah. That was a sort of anti-spoiler, yeah.
Yeah, that was a big letdown for me, honestly.
How do you make a movie with Ultron in it and you don't have Thor say that?
But you know what? There's a cut in the movie where there's an obvious edit with Thor speaking to Ultron at the end of the movie where it could be inserted in the longer cut. Just want to say that.
So you think it's in that 3 hour?
It better be in that cut.
I was buzzing the whole last 45 minutes of the film anyway, but I was at the point where every time Thor and Ultron were on the screen at the same time, I was like, say the line, say the line.
It's like the whole movie could be total garbage, but as long as he says that line, I would have a smile on my face.
Yep, we would have words with the.
Well, I think that's one thing that there looks like there were several different things that was cut out of this movie.
I really needed a Tom DeFalco text box telling me what was going on during certain scenes. Honestly,
I don't know.
As seen in Winter Soldier, number one.
I saw it twice, and I didn't really pick up on a lot of these like edits that people were talking about. Like, I could basically follow where everything was and what was going on. Nothing jumped out at me as any obvious edit, so I don't know. Maybe
the,
I just
the big one
it.
is the Thor goes to a magical pool to get answers.
I'm not talking about stuff that was in the trailer that we
I'm talking about like just like the movie things, like what's going on here. I have no idea what just happened.
Yeah, that's
the big one for me. I was like,
well,
that's probably the single weirdest most disappointing bit of the entire film, honestly. Not so much because of what's not because it's cut down or anything, but just because it's, I think we know at this stage that Marvel enforced that upon the film.
Yeah.
It's like it is just the obligatory here's where the heroes find out properly about the stones bit.
It could have been handled better.
Yeah, that was Thor didn't have a lot to do in this film. Thor, I mean,
he really didn't.
No, this film, it's a very full film.
Yeah. And we didn't even get a good shirtless scene with him. Come on.
director's cut. You know, it's coming.
Never know. Yeah. I mean, he gets naked and goes in that pool, so.
The only thing I liked about that pool is it gave us the insight to Ragnarok. Yay!
Yeah, you would assume that that's largely foreshadowing the next Thor film.
That was Hela. I swear I saw Hela. I was just like, wait. When I saw it the second time, I'm like, yep, that was her. I know it.
Yay. Was it just a quick little cut or something? Because yeah, I didn't see it. I didn't catch it.
You could see her helmet and like she's screaming.
Ah,
real quick cut.
Oh, well, I'll have to go again. No one ashamed.
Yeah. I was so excited because she's one of my favorite characters.
I saw the movie twice and I was expecting to catch more things in the second viewing, but I didn't catch a whole lot. In that second viewing, like, I mean, I liked it better in the second viewing. I think maybe having some time away from it and thinking about it and then going into it and readjusting expectations, it became a better movie. Because first viewing, it was not the best movie I've ever seen.
It was the other way. Like, normally, the second viewing, I think more about the movie, but the second viewing, I was able to shut my brain off more.
Yeah.
I liked it better.
See, I was the other way around completely. I came out of it and I was like, that was the best thing ever. I have no objective opinion about this. I need to see this again in order to unpack this and try and... And then I went a second time and it didn't work in the slightest. And I came out and I was like, this is still brilliant. I don't know.
Okay.
So I find it very hard to be in any way objective about the film. You know, I mean, my sort of overview of it was that In pretty much every regard, the first Avengers is a better made film.
I was afraid that it'd be controversial if I said that I liked the first movie better.
Oh no, I think that's the opinion of most people.
Because and I don't know, it's not so much that it's maybe a better made movie, that it's a better written movie, but like I was telling Brian, I think you only kind of get to make the Avengers once, and then every time you do after that, you're just trying to remake that movie, you know. I mean, you know what I mean. Like the build to the first movie was epic. You know, it was this thing you were looking forward to. The build to the second movie, not so much.
It was a better product of its time than this one is. And
yeah,
I liked it better because of it.
Yeah,
it's hard to know how you keep doing things on this scale. But I mean, for me, and it's just a product of me being me and being a nerd and everything. It's just the things that this movie was doing and the characters that this movie was doing excited me more than, and not just like in prospect, and the way that they did them excited me more than Loki and his faceless goon squad of aliens.
Yeah.
I cannot suppress my Ultron love.
Ultron was amazing.
Ultron's fantastic. He's the best thing about it. I mean, good
far and away the best thing.
No.
I'm waiting. Tell me what. Uh-huh. Don't keep me waiting anymore.
Did I cut out?
Yeah, I think
slightly.
The Vision was the best thing about it for me. Like, I spent the last, basically, you know, my brain, the last 45 minutes of the film, the hamster got off the wheel and just was like, The Vision is in a film. The Vision is in a film. Is he going to do the density? He did the density. Is he going to shoot lasers? He shot lasers. The Vision is in a film. I
like The Vision, but nah, it's James Spader. That's perfect casting.
About Vision. I like the little hint that him and Scarlet Witch, where he picked her up. I'm like,
I like that.
That was,
I had to explain to people that they get together, like, how? And I'm like, I'll tell you when you're older.
Honestly, on my first viewing,
But then, like, he comes in and he swoops just in the last, what is it, like the 5 minutes from the end or something? Yeah. I'm already freaking out, and he swoops in and picks her up, and the camera just goes slow-mo enough to linger on, and, like, it turns to the audience and goes, hey, nerds, you know what we're referencing? And I'm like, no, I did the thing. And that was me. You know?
I was so happy when that happened.
I'll be honest. On my first viewing of the movie, I thought the Vision was silly.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. I like the Vision.
Me too. I love the Vision.
But the thing is, it's like the rest of the characters, maybe it's because of like the other movies and they've just had so many movies to get it right. They feel like they're lived in, and the Vision felt like something off of a comic page. He felt like something from another world.
He just felt out of place.
He felt out of place. Like the first time
Not in a good way.
Yeah, but then in the second viewing, it's like, all right, I'm more okay with it's this.
Exactly the same here.
I feel like that's
something that we're going to experience a lot more of going forward, though.
Oh yeah,
I mean, there's a little element of it in this, but whenever the Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver tool up to go fighting alongside the Avengers, like they go and put on costumes, you know, they go and get color coded shit. He picks a shirt with a lightning bolt on the front of it, and yeah. She's like, "Let me get all gothy, Hot Topic-y here." And it's like, because we've reached, and you guys remember what I was saying about wanting a Spider-Man film that starts with them duffing up the Shocker or something, because I want films to present me with a world where the fantastic is sort of an inbuilt element and not everything is so huge just to be an event in and of itself. But the Marvel Cinematic Universe has attained a point now where superheroes are a thing within the framework of that world, and they wear costumes because it's just something that they do. They don't have to wear clothes that slyly wink towards their comic book costumes. They don't have to wear body armor that they then paint a funny color or something. They just wear costumes because it's something that superheroes do. See Daredevil. And so I think that we're going to, as we go along, I mean, particularly, never mind tooling up to go and fight. Like at the very end, when the Scarlet Witch comes in, she's wearing like a long flowing robe coat thing. And I'm like, that's a costume. She got a costume because she's a superhero, because that's what superheroes do. And finally, we're at that point now. And that excites me.
I guess we should say that we will be talking about spoilers.
I think we've already spoiled a lot.
Yeah, it's
spoiled. I know, but
if anyone's missed this episode, this movie, then I don't.
Because I want to ask a question. This is the question that me and my fellow nerds have been arguing. Do you think Quicksilver is really dead?
Fox did it better. Hope so.
I heard, I don't know how true this is, but I heard in that cut, he's there at the end with them, wearing any costume. Like, you know, there when you have, like, the new Avengers, you have Captain America and Widow and War Machine and Falcon, all that he's been cut out of that, and that he's actually there with them, and that's there's some explanation as to how he survived or something. It's what I've heard, but I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, because dude got shot to pieces. I'm sorry. I mean, Quicksilver's awesome.
He's dead.
But I think
well,
he's dead.
I wish I cared more. But I mean, like, so a lot of people said, most people, in fact, sensibler people than I, read the film as doing all the cliches to make out that Hawkeye would die.
Yeah,
people make fun of how useless he was. They gave him the family and everything.
Well, the big thing is, like, one of Whedon's things is, like, he'll create happiness, make characters happy, and he'll murder the hell out of those characters.
But
they
you know what?
Die tragically.
I don't know if it was just the fact that I was caught up in the film so much, or the fact that, and I'll come back to this later, I really didn't like the fact that he had a secret family. But
I didn't either. That's not Hawkeye.
I thought it was weird.
We'll come back to that. I didn't read that way. So I didn't. So whenever Quicksilver died at the end, I didn't, on my initial watch, I didn't read it as a fake out so much as I did. He died, and I was like, oh, well, I guess that's what happens whenever your character's co-licensed with Fox then. And like, so my first impact was not that I had been duped for maximum emotional punch, but rather that complicated legal things surrounding the character had necessitated that he be killed.
Yeah, I was thinking that after the movie. I was thinking, like, you know, of the characters that they would kill off, it does make sense to kill him off because maybe that deal was only for one movie.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they'd worked it out for one movie or something.
I mean, I don't mind Quicksilver or anything, but I'm not sad that he's gone. You know, whenever I think of a classical Avengers team up in my head, when I piece my Avengers all stars together from throughout time and space, Quicksilver is not
he's not needed as much as a Vision in Scarlet Witch.
Well, the thing is my experience in the theater. Joss Whedon did a good job for the amount of time that he was on the screen. When he finally, when they did that pullback shot and you see all the bullets in him, you could hear the audience sigh, like, oh, really?
I think it got pretty quiet in our theater, didn't it, Brian?
Yeah.
That kid was crying.
That kid never shut up. I forgot about that.
Well, if you want to talk about audience reaction, though, then you got to talk about the hammer.
Yeah. I like that.
That was amazing.
That was a really great build-up, too, because they kind of played it off as just kind of this funny scene. And I kind of thought the end of it was going to be Steve. When you got that great reaction from Thor, he was like worried to death he's going to fall out of his seat there for a second. It's like, oh, they're not going back to that. That's not going to come back.
But that's all you think. You think it's just a little funny scene where you get to see the characters off, out of costume, off the clock, as it were.
Yeah.
And it's just a bit of, and that's all it is. And it's just a masterful bit of writing to then swoop back around to that at the end, because it's at a point in the progression of the film where you can't, like, there's like, we're like 20 minutes from the end here. There is no time for, like, where rationally everyone really would go, this robot was built by Ultron and it's got like half Ultron's programming in it. No.
No way we should trust this person. And there's absolutely nothing you can do story-wise to make us trust this person. Oh, wait, he's holding the hammer.
I thought it was cheesy. I thought that was the cheesiest moment in the movie.
Really? Oh, I liked it.
I mean, like, this is the whole thing. It's just like Cap said, you know, he's in, like, a freaking elevator. Like, you know, that meant nothing to me.
I think I was very much caught up in the moment because I saw it twice, as I say, both times, whenever the hammer, and it's shot perfectly as well, so that there is silence just long enough as all the Avengers look on, and you can hear the audience reactions, and just around the theater, you could hear.
It was pretty quiet. I seem to remember it was pretty quiet.
You could hear the sort of screaming kid to that girl.
There's some laughs. I mean, like, you know, like, oh, wow, huh? But
You know, just like the two times it was a real reaction of hushed awe. It was, I mean, after the fact that I was like, yeah, but the Vision can't do that in the comics. But then they saved it at the very end whenever they had the discussion about an elevator being able to lift the hammer. I was like, thank you, that's good, okay, you've kept me happy, because I mean, like, really, any actual problems that I have with this film, honestly, are, and I hold my hand up to this, but they are just petulant, nerdy foot stomping.
Yeah.
Just petulant. It's not like that in the comics, stomping of my foot, because I don't like the Banner Widow stuff, and I don't like Hawkeye having a secret family.
I just don't like Hawkeye.
Don't either. Why don't you like Hawkeye?
I don't like the movie Hawkeye. I love the comic Hawkeye.
Yeah.
I really like the idea of Jeremy Renner as Hawkeye. I remember whenever he first appeared in Thor.
Yeah.
Like, his one line of dialogue was like, you better make a decision, Fury. I'm starting to root for this guy. And I was like, that's fucking Hawkeye.
Yeah, they put him in the character. But, like, since then, I don't know. Like, that would be, like, the one thing I don't like about the first movie.
He's a blank slate in the first movie.
Yeah, pretty much. And then they try to make him a good character in this one, and they sort of succeed, but they succeed in a weird way, and then it's not, again, like you said, it's not like the Hawkeye that I want. Maybe, I don't know, I don't read, like, the new Hawkeye comics, so maybe that's
it's nothing. It's really, it's Hawkeye.
It's just because, Ultimate Hawkeye had a family, didn't he? So
that's where the family comes from, and I forgot. From.
I didn't even know that.
That's where they took that from. I forgot. I mean, like, Hawkeye is a cocky screw up. That's Hawkeye's thing. He is a screw up who is always trying to prove himself to everyone around him and usually shitting it up along the way, but winning out in the end. That's classical Hawkeye. And this Hawkeye is the ultimate Hawkeye without the badass flip out and kill everybody attitude. So he's somehow they somehow turned Hawkeye into the heart of the team, which is just not what Hawkeye is.
No. I mean, I don't hate it, but I don't love it. I'm sort of in the middle on it.
It's well done for what it is, and it does, in many regards, tie the film together. But it's just me taking my giant fucking fan foot and going, not like that in the comics. And I hold my hand up to that.
Is it sad that all I really want him to do is, like, do something in it, shock Captain America, and then later on they go play baseball, and Cap says, be careful, Hawkeye cheats. That's what I really want.
I just want to put a Wolverine mask on, personally.
There you go, But yeah,
and I didn't buy into the Banner Widow stuff. But again, that's just me going, it's not like that in the comics. It's like internal to the film. I can see what they're doing. It works from what they've established with the characters. But again, now this is just it's the same as the way I read the Hawkeye and Quicksilver thing before.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in Christendom took Black Widow and Hawkeye as being, if not a thing, then
they're going to be a thing at some point.
Be a thing, or that at the very least, even if the partnership was just friends, that it was just sort of thing that the audience read it that way, you know.
And we should have been smarter, because like in the first movie, she says, you know, love is for children.
Yeah,
and we should have been like, all right, you know, she don't. Yeah, it's not that.
But they're identified as a pair. Either way, and it's not actually wrong for anyone to read it that way, because that's how the characters start out in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they first appeared back in the 60s, Black Widow was a Russian spy who was stringing along a smitten Hawkeye to get him to commit crimes for her. But he really did fall for her. He really did love her. So it's not incorrect to interpret the characters that way. So because I wasn't reading the Hawkeye thing as set up in order to fake out a death, all I interpreted the Secret Family as was, well, he had to give him that so that the audience would buy the Hulk and Banner together, would buy the Widow and Banner together. It was like, it's just me misreading the signs with my big nerdy head, but it was basically the family was the narrative's necessary excuse to take Hawkeye off the table romantically so that the audience would accept the Widow being with Hulk. But again, it's just me, and I know that's not what it was. At least I don't think that's what it was. There's a conspiratorial part of me. It's like, maybe more like the comics, because we're just at a point with these films now where they're like, don't, you know, if it ain't broke, and they're lifting so many characters and their emotions and their arcs off the comic page and putting them on the screen to fabricate something so whole cloth like that sits ill.
Hey, speaking of Banner and the Hulk, is the whole reference to the Hulkbuster armor as Veronica some sort of strained reference to Betty? I don't get it.
I don't really get it, but I understand that that's what it is, but I don't really get it. It's like, yeah, where?
I thought it was a badass scene.
I mean, the fight.
This just reminds me of the question I wanted to ask you guys.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so Scarlet Witch, she does her little voodoo and the dream sequence with everyone, but we never saw the Hulk's dream sequence. So what do you think that he saw?
Red, green. Green, he saw green. I don't know. I mean, like, that's interesting. Maybe that's a thing that got cut.
What
Banner would see would, they showed them all like things to make them fear and doubt, and probably what Banner would see would be the Hulk on a rampage, and then he lost control of his emotions and boom.
I just thought it was weird that they didn't show what he saw.
Well, again, maybe the extended cut.
Maybe there's something out there.
But it's sort of those things where the narrative doesn't really require it, because again, it's quite elegant, where it's like, well, if Banner's emotions get screwed with, the audience knows what happens. Oh, it happened.
Yeah.
Smashing happened.
So
the Hulkbuster fight is probably the high point of the film.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. I liked it a lot. So, McFeely, are you ready for a Black Panther movie?
You know what?
We were in Wakanda. There was a claw.
And that was, this is the thing, right? So we're watching the film, right? And I lean over to Jeff and I nudge him and I go, do you know what would be fucking brilliant? If he got his arm sliced. Oh! It was stuff like that all through the movie where I was like,
He's got the little mark burning the back of his neck because he's been stealing vibranium. So he already hates them.
I mean, like, I don't care for the Black Panther very much.
Yeah.
The Hickman's New Avengers is the most I have ever cared about the Black Panther. I am not particularly excited about the Black Panther film.
If I'm going to get
fucking Claw, then I'm excited about the film. Like, I'm more excited at the prospect of seeing Claw in a film than I am.
Because I keep on saying that to people. I'm like, I don't think Black Panther needs his own movie. I don't think so.
They need to diversify their cast of middle-aged white people.
Yeah,
and Black Panther is easily the smartest, best choice for a person of color.
It's
film.
Got Sam,
and it would be kind of a cool
Falcon
thing.
Is not a film. Yeah. Falcon.
I think it would be kind of a cool film because of the whole he's a ruler of a nation type thing. Because we haven't really had a superhero that's a ruler of a nation yet, have we?
Definitely a new slant to be pulled with that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a different type of a story.
But I have just never been very attached to the character. So it's like, it's the same as with the Inhumans, you know. And I think the really ironic thing is like that the two films that Marvel have announced that I'm least excited about are the Black Panther and the Inhumans, characters who were birthed out of being supporting Fantastic Four cast members.
Yeah.
And me, a huge Fantastic Four fan. And I'm like, well, whatever.
Yeah, those are my least interested films that are coming.
Yeah.
But I'm excited for Doctor Strange. That's what it's all about, man.
Bring it.
Doctor Strange is so
exciting. Oh, Civil War is looking very exciting, I have to say, with everybody that's going to be in it.
Yeah, so like Civil War is Avengers 2.5.
I mean,
pretty much.
Because like the only person that's not in it is what, Banner? The Hulk?
Yeah, but he's vanished. So. Yeah.
Well, did you hear the stuff about Hulk? Like, I don't know if this is why he leaves, but it's like there's some legal deal with Universal.
I don't know what that is. That's been very confused. Nobody's really talked about it much, but I guess no, it never really occurred to anybody. But I think Universal does still have distribution rights to Hulk movies.
Yeah, it's like something to do with when they made Incredible Hulk, right? It's some sort of legal.
It was distributed by Universal, I think.
Yeah.
Ruffalo hinted that he may be in Civil War, by the way.
I mean, there should be a Hulk solo movie if they can work it out. It shouldn't be Planet Hulk. Don't be fucking stupid. But there should be.
I think that'd be awesome.
Oh, it would be awesome. But not yet.
Not yet.
We had Guardians. People did well with
Guardians.
Yes,
the two worlds haven't met yet. At what point in the Marvel Cinematic Universe landscape, as it exists now, does a secret cabal of superheroes get together and shoot the Hulk into space?
After the Infinity Gauntlet.
Yes.
Because we've dealt with something so terrible and so awful that we now have to have an Illuminati.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, that's not impossible. You know, I mean, if they take custody of the gems. Like in the comics, you know. Although, I mean, I'm not sure who would be on it, because it would be just the Avengers, really, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, you got Doctor
Strange.
Really
be an Illuminati. They don't have the rights to half the guys on the thing.
You got Strange. You've got Tony and Black Panther, and that's it, isn't it?
Well, there's Reed, and they don't have Reed. Yeah. And there's Namor, and I don't think they have Namor.
They don't.
What
would Namor fall under? Like, if you were selling movie rights,
I think he might have his own rights. Honestly,
he has his own thing, so he doesn't fall under like X-Men or whatever. Avengers or something.
So, probably pull this back to actually talking about the film a bit.
Yeah.
I think I said at the very start, it's a very full film. And everyone was worried that this could come apart under that. And it doesn't. I think that's if there's any one huge success this film has, it's that it manages to hold itself together. Everyone honestly, and obviously there was the concern that they wouldn't be able to manage such a large cast and large chunks of people would wind up with nothing to do. And they do. Everybody gets something to do. Thor is the one who doesn't get a lot to do, but his role is essential in the film. His hammer is more important than he is in the film, but he gets that his presence is warranted in that. So it's just full is the I couldn't call it like overstuffed, because if it was overstuffed, it would be like a delicious burger stuffed with meat, you know. But it's that a film with so many wheels in motion, so many moving parts could succeed at all is the real triumph of the film, I think.
Yeah, I could understand why Joss Whedon would want to walk away, because I'd say he probably had multiple nervous breakdowns while working on this movie. Mm-hmm. It's like, is this going to work? You know, can we get all this to work together? You know,
and then you look at something like, I mean, one has to assume that Civil War, like the Avengers, will just sort of be like kind of side roles in it. You know, it won't be really an ensemble cast the way Avengers is. It's like it'll be. I mean, but we do kind of ask the question now, is like, what makes this a Captain America movie, you know?
Yeah.
And the other would seem to be because Baron Zemo and Crossbones are in it.
I so called it last year when we were talking Winter Soldier. I'm like, I would love it if it was Baron Zemo. And 2 weeks later they announced it. I'm like, hat on his shoulder.
I love Zemo, and I'm glad he'll be in it, but I hope he gets handled a little bit better than Strucker did in the Avengers.
Oh my gosh, that was so sad. I'm like,
that was really quick and get rid of this guy.
No, I hated that it was off scene. I mean, it was just what?
Like the best thing about him was that, like, you will fight and not surrender, and then he turns to the camera and says, "We are going to surrender." That's it. That's all he's got going for him in the movie.
It's a bit of a shame. I mean, I mean, they sort of implied that was kind of it for Hydra. You know, we've seen the other heads of Hydra be taken down in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, and like Strucker was kind of the last. So it's like, it is a shame to sort of throw a character like Strucker out there like that. So I'm not. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has reached a point now where they're also willing to admit when they screw up. Mm-hmm. Witness the return of the, what's it called? The Hail to the King short, where they fix their Mandarin mistake.
Yes. So, I like that. That was funny.
That was pretty fun. I like that, though.
I like that for Sam Rockwell. That's why I liked it so much.
I mean, there were some slightly problematic elements to it. It's one of the first things out of the MCU that I wouldn't feel super comfortable about showing to a child.
Yeah.
I didn't like that. And, you know, some problematic, questionable choices as far as gay characters as well. But
I liked that Sam Rockwell was in it. Because I love Sam Rockwell in Iron Man 2. He's the best thing about Iron Man 2. He is hilarious.
He is not old enough. Justin Hammer is supposed to be old. He's ultimate. Justin.
Okay.
No. But besides that, they were willing to say, yeah, we screwed that one up. He fixed that. So, you know, I think there's room to, you know, maybe go back, you know, maybe strap the Satan claw onto Strucker's corpse, maybe drain some life force in there. Maybe we're all good. Maybe an Infinity Gem could bring him back to life or something. It would be.
Okay. Talk about gems. Mm-hmm. So does this mean, because, well, they're going to have to collect the gems. Does this mean that Vision's going to get killed off?
I think he's going to get his head ripped off and that gem yanked out of it, and it's going to be really sad.
The gem is just what gives him the power, you know, so he doesn't have to have the gem to be alive, as far as I gather. The gem
still,
just...
I think someone's going to try to take that gem from him, and they're going to yank his head off and take the gem out.
See, that's not how I interpreted it in the movie, because once they place a gem in him, that's when he came to life. So is that the soul gem? Is that the soul gem?
It's the mind gem.
It's the mind gem, I mean. Yeah. So, okay.
Well, Ultron puts the JM on it, then after that, he starts transferring his consciousness into it, and he only gets halfway. And then Tony and Bruce put Jarvis into the body, so it's kind of a Jarvis Ultron composite. The JM itself doesn't seem to be doing anything other than shooting lasers.
Speaking of the transfer of Ultron, is that the out? If they ever wanted to say, "Hey, he didn't die. Oh, he's in the Vision."
AI villains. They have that out, but anyway. But it's like then that lets you do the Ultron imperative notion from the comics, where creations of Ultron are compelled to recreate Ultron.
Yeah.
So maybe if the Mind Stone is removed, and maybe the Vision's mind has to reboot or something. There's a million gateways to bring Ultron back if they ever want to.
James Spader come back, man.
Yeah. Ultron was great overall. There were some elements of the character I wasn't big on. I didn't like him being snarky.
I liked that. You know why I liked it? Because his origins are different. He wasn't created by Hank Pym. He was created by Tony Stark, so he's an evil Tony Stark.
But
that's why I like it.
But it wasn't based on Stark's brain patterns or anything.
They did work on it. I mean, like, they didn't finish it because they were doing something with it. And so it's a child that hates his father but can't help it because he's so much like his father. And it's evident in there because every time they make reference, it's like Stark said that, and then he tears his claw's arm off.
It was there. I mean, I am still the nerd that is pissed off that Ultron and Hank Pym are making their first ever cinematic live-action debuts of all time in two films released in the same year, 3 months apart, in a shared universe, and they're connected to one another. And I'm like, what the hell?
Don't even get me started with that. I try to explain it to people, and they're like, really? And I'm just like, yeah, don't even know.
Yeah, I hate it, but I can live with it. I'm fine. Because I'm
still holding out hope that the Ultron was developed by Hank Pym for S.H.I.E.L.D. in the 60s, then mothballed and unearthed by Tony.
There you go.
Anyway, back to Ultron, though. I did want more of... See, the snarky thing took away for me from the lonely Oedipal robot that Ultron should be. You know, they flirt with the Oedipal ideas where he hates his dad and everything. But I'll be honest, the first thing I thought when Black Widow woke up in the cell was, robot bride? We making a robot bride? Yeah, no, that's what you do? Yeah, no, okay. Boo.
Speaking of robot bride, is Friday Jocasta?
No, because if you look, you can actually see Jocasta is on one of the other circuit cards that he doesn't pick up.
Oh, well, really? I didn't catch that. I just figured, it's a girl AI. Maybe they're hinting at doing Jocasta at some point or something.
Friday was an AI. Mike Grail created Friday in 2000, early 2000s.
Okay.
Didn't stick.
Okay.
About much, but that's where basically those cards had the names of, because when Frank Thierry was writing the book before Grail took over, Jocasta was the AI that was running the armor.
I forgot about that. I try to forget about Frank Thierry.
Yeah. I'd had Ultron in it too.
Yeah.
And to me, like that's what distinguishes, like, Ultron is okay. I don't know if how long sort of sentient AI killer robot replaced the world with mechanical life plots have existed, how long they've been a staple of sci-fi, but Ultron's been kicking about for 50 years trying to do that. Yeah. So I'm willing to say that he predates a lot of the elements that make the nerds of today familiar with that as a trope, as a sci-fi plotline, that can make it seem, it's like, so the Avengers are fighting a killer robot that's trying to replace all life on the planet with robots. Well, big, what's new about that, you know? And it's like, well, the answer is, well, they did it first. I don't know if they did, but you know what I'm saying? So to me, the lonely Oedipal aspect of Ultron is what distinguishes Ultron from just being any other killer AI robot storyline. And they do it a bit with him hating Stark. And I mean, I really, really liked, it was one line, but I really liked it because it was service towards the idea. When the Widow wakes up in the cell and Ultron turns to her and he goes, what is it he says?
He's like, I'm glad you're awake. Because I had no one else to show.
Yeah, there was no one else to show. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, poor sad robot. Yeah. I was like, that's right. That's, yeah. So that, again, I struggle to be objective about the film. So much of it just for me is couched in what I understand of the characters and the universe and from the comics that, believe me, I loved the film, no question. But as we're talking about it being a very full film with a lot of moving parts, like compared to the first Avengers, there's not a lot going on in the first Avengers.
No,
I like the first Avengers. I like it all. As a piece of filmmaking, it's like top three from the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
Top four, maybe. But I can't rewatch it a lot because there's not a lot going on in it.
I'll rewatch it if it shows up on FX. Yeah, I'll catch it sometimes and rewatch it.
Yeah.
It's Loki.
I mean, I had the opportunity to go to a triple bill of Avengers, Winter Soldier, and Age of Ultron.
I could have done it,
but I was like,
I couldn't do that. No,
if it was just Winter Soldier and Age of Ultron, I would do it, but I don't want to go and see the Avengers again.
They had a 24-hour marathon here. I know a couple people that did it.
That's ridiculous. That watched
every single of the Marvel films, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
I can't understand why you would want your first experience of a brand new exciting film to be at the end of a grueling period where you're dehydrated and sleepy. What kind of experience is that?
Apparently, they loved it. So,
nerd dick measuring. That's the type of people who do that.
I want to say that that last scene where they're all fighting to keep the Ultrons away from the machine is like Alex Ross just like just threw up all over the screen, and it was awesome.
I mean, yeah,
there was a scene like that in the first Avengers movie where they're all just sort of like fighting the aliens, and that's like the point where my brain is like, am I dreaming? Is this reality? Am I seeing this in a film? And it kind of had the same effect again in this one where like you see like just all these sort of just fighting the good fight, you know, they may die, they may not, who knows, but they're all just together, you know, they're Avengers. I was like, oh my God.
You know what I also really like about that is, and I think if JD were here, he would hopefully agree with this because it was one of his big beefs with the original Avengers. We remember how when Iron Man blows up the spaceship, all the Chitauri just turn off.
Yeah.
But in this one, there's no off switch. They, yeah, honest to God, smash all those robots.
Yeah.
Like the Avengers, just they take them all on.
He can't escape. He can't duck into the internet and get away, but they got to make sure they kill every single one of them. Can't let one of them get away.
I mean, I was just buzzing the last 45 minutes, you know, so I can't unpack it. I can't form a proper opinion. So, you know, when the helicarrier turns up, you're like, what? I wonder if that's Data Protocol. And then,
cool. Like, if you were also watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I thought that was kind of cool.
And then, you know, whenever the Ultrons start trying to get away and they go, you're up. And I'm like, who's up? What's happening? And then War Machine comes in and goes, the War Machine.
War Machine is maybe secretly the best character in the movie.
Secretly.
He might be because of just the whole, you know, boom, this is what you were looking for.
Yeah.
And then, like, they treat him so badly, and he's just so, so sad. And then he shows up to save the day and help, and it's so cool.
And he showed up to save the day for, like, 5 seconds.
And then they do the whole thing. I mean, he's a great character. He's a great character in it because he's the guy that's not – he's not really, like a god. You know, he's not a Captain America or a Thor or something, but he's sort of like almost there. He's like an Avenger, but even when like he sees the Vision, he's like, "What the hell?" You know, he's like, "What?"
That just happened. Yeah.
I'm gonna go back to Ultron for a second, though, to leave the lonely Oedipal thing aside. Ultron is, I think, as far as the film goes, Ultron's kind of saved by Spader's performance because. Yeah. And again, it's hard for me to get too down on it because as a nerd and a huge fan of Ultron, he does all the things that I expect Ultron to do. He periodically upgrades himself. He creates the Vision. He tries to wipe out human life and replace it with robots. But internal to those 2.5 hours, I don't feel like the character really gets any kind of arc or flow to what he does. You know, there is a constant sense of escalation from him, but there never seem to be any inciting incidents which actually spark the escalation.
Yeah. They pretty much get going. They just keep
to do the
going.
Next thing now because it's that time in the plot. So that's when he's supposed to step up his plot, even though nothing has happened to actually, you know, cause him to change what he's doing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but whenever he upgrades his body at the end, then I'm like, yeah, you did. You put a
vibrator. That was awesome. That was one of my most favorite scenes when he punches a hole through himself and there's his
whenever
new self.
And he finishes the sentence of the first robot.
Makes me strong.
Like the first robot's talking and then he murders it and then he finishes that sentence.
I just about lost it there. Yeah, I really did. Cool. I was like, that's so awesome.
I know that he had to have a more expressive face, but again, I do really wish that he like his little circular cheek vents open when he gets angry and it gives him the sort of jack-o'-lantern mouth.
Well, all his individual robots, you know, had that classic.
Yeah, they did.
And then they ended it with he was in one of those. So literally the last scene you see of him is a classic Ultron look.
With the red eyes. I loved it.
You're unbearably naive.
I was just born yesterday.
That was an awesome line too.
Vision was in a film.
Yeah, it's cool.
I mean, the Vision is sort of, I don't know why it is, but the Vision is kind of like sort of the glue to me for the Avengers. Is like it never quite feels like the Avengers if the Vision isn't kicking about.
Shouldn't he really be like the heart of the Avengers other than Hawkeye?
I mean, he ties a lot of things together. I mean, obviously we don't have Wonder Man to bring into the equation here. And, you know, being honest, like if you're doing the Vision story in a film, like Wonder Man's role is literally the first thing you cut out.
Yeah.
But I mean, they replaced him with Jarvis essentially.
Yeah, because Jarvis has been around. He's been in multiple movies, and you've gotten used to him. You like him. You love that character, even though it's just a voice. It's a great character.
Oh well, talk about Paul Bentley. Can I say he did such a great job as Vision? And kudos to the studio for not making him CGI. They actually did some practical effects, some nice makeup on him. And I'm like,
I'm glad they used him as the actor, you know?
Yes.
Like before all of this, before we knew where all this was going, who knows what they were going to do, you know? But I'm glad that they used him as the actor since he's been doing the voice, you know, for all of it.
He was the Vision, and the Vision was in a film.
Yes.
I don't have any, he's just so...
You've said that pretty much about all the movies, like Guardians. You're like, we actually had Ronan. We had Ronan.
What a time to be alive.
I know. So what you're saying is that there's nothing else. There's nothing they can do in Avengers 3, right?
I mean, I don't know what you could... It's like, you know, I'm excited that Baron Zemo is in a film, but...
Yeah.
Vision
I'm excited
was in a
for
film.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, Vision's the big
one. I just can't wait to...
I don't think they've 100% confirmed Zemo's in it, but I think it's a...
No, I think I was listening to a Marvel podcast and they've confirmed it. I just want to know, are they going for the classic hood?
I need to see a Nazi who accidentally glued a sock to his face. I need that.
I know, I'm just wondering if that's what they're really
going to
do. Or...
They're not going to do it, obviously.
Are they
going to
do the sun? Are they going to do Son of Zemo, probably?
That's it. I mean, the Avengers cartoon, the Earth's Mightiest Heroes, probably did it the smartest way, where there was one Baron Zemo who just lived through, and he had the son's look in the present day and the father's look in the World War II era.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, what that allowed them to do was it allowed them to do the classic 1960s Avengers stories where Heinrich Zemo it was only 20 years after World War II, so Heinrich Zemo could still be kicking around and actually have a rematch with Captain America and everything. But now that we're 50 years on from that, he can't still be kicking around anymore without, you know, medical intervention, so without scientific intervention. Yeah. So, but then that in turn then removes the need for Helmet to exist. But Helmet is the infinitely cooler character, so Heinrich essentially becomes Helmet and has all the characteristics of Helmet. A lot of people seem to think it might mean Thunderbolts might happen, but I don't know.
God, really? I'd love to see a Thunderbolts movie. I love the Thunderbolts.
I'd be behind it. And people seem to be sort of jumping to the conclusion that because Zemo's in it and because it's Civil War themed,
I just had an idea.
Mm.
All of the actors are leaving after the next couple of movies. If you need to replace the Avengers, do a Thunderbolts movie. There you go. They become the new Avengers.
Something else.
And they're villains. Villains. I want that movie now.
There's Crossbones. And what else do you put in there? Who else bees in the Thunderbolts?
I don't know. They can like put something together.
Follow up these ideas, Dougal.
They need to do that. They need to do that now.
People did also think, and this was the point where I thought, okay, maybe the fact that we just got confirmation recently that I forget the actor's name, but the actor who played General Ross in The Incredible Hulk is coming back for this.
He's going to be in Civil War, yeah. It's John Hurt? No, what, not John Hurt. God, no, what is his name?
Curtis. I can't remember.
His name. Yeah, but I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah,
was it Sam Elliott, or was that the other
one?
No, it was the other one.
Okay.
He was the superior general, Ross.
Yes.
The guy in The Incredible Hulk kind of had a really sort of fake, angry American general voice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, thundering typhoons. But the thought was like, first of all, right, that General Ross, he totally hates superheroes.
Yeah.
We also know that he has been striving to have super soldiers under his command. And what's General Ross's nickname?
Thunderbolt.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
And I was like, okay, maybe the signs are kind of aligning for that one.
You know what we're probably going to get? He's probably going to be the Red Hulk.
Oh, fuck me. Fuck
I know. Me. I just thought of that. It's like, oh, wait.
Shut up and get up. Oh.
Secretly, the villain of Civil War is the Red Hulk.
What would you have a problem with the Red Hulk Civil War for?
Jet Loeb.
Why do you have such a problem with Red Hulk?
He's terrible.
Red Hulk is just universally terrible. Do you know what Red Hulk's superhero name is?
What?
Red Hulk. What the hell is that? What is that? That doesn't make sense. That's a descriptor.
Why don't they just call him Thunderbolt?
Probably confused people.
Okay.
Oh, God, no. Oh, they would need to not do that.
Hey, you know what She-Hulk's superhero name is? She-Hulk.
She-Hulk?
Yeah, but that's it. It's not Woman Hulk. It's not Lady Hulk.
Hulk Woman.
Hulk, it's not Hulk Woman. Anyway.
I would have been okay with Wonder Hulk.
Wonder?
Okay, I think maybe we better wrap it up.
Okay.
So the final observation I want to make is one that I have to steal from someone else, which is it's something that makes one eager to see the extended cut. I'm not usually a man who's very bothered about extended cuts, but I'm excited at the prospect of anything more being added to this film. But that's because it's held together. I think the thing that holds it together, and it quite holds it together quite subtly, because you really have to be trying to examine the film to really pick up on it, which is the central theme of the film of permanence versus impermanence and evolution versus stagnation. And it's a sensible theme to have with Ultron, because that's a character who's trying to move things on to the next phase of life.
Mm-hmm.
But the film is about accepting the notion of, basically, Tony, and by extension the Avengers, are fighting to to end the Avengers, to win the war, and for the Avengers to cease to be. But a victory, that's still a state of stagnation. That's still an absolute. And Ultron is fighting to eradicate humanity and replace the world with only him. He's not trying to create a metallic race because the robots he makes will only be him. That's a state of stagnation. Nothing grows from either of those. The vision is what represents the core theme of that, where it's about things coming together and moving on. And that's where we are at the end of the film, and that Stark has tagged out, as he describes it himself, but the Avengers go on in a new form. And these are not crowd-pleasing film themes.
Vision has that great line at the end of the movie, where he's talking to Ultron.
Because it lasts, and I'm like, damn.
Yeah.
You know, that scene is about encapsulating the, I wouldn't call it buried, but a theme that is handled in such a way as to shape the film, but not make a casual audience come away from a film saying that's what that film was about, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But it's not a theme. Basically, the theme of the film is letting go.
Yeah.
Letting go, moving on, and accepting that things are going to change. And that's not a crowd-pleasing film. So there may be an element of like some sort of subconsciously people are like, as I said, that scene with the Vision is like just a thing isn't beautiful because it lasts. I was like, that's.
Yeah.
But the idea that the hero and the villain were both fighting for equal and opposite states of impermanence and the true way forward came from the Vision, the balance between the two. It was like, that's pretty damn smart.
Yeah.
You know, this was not some big, dumb, loud film. You know, there were real intelligent ideas tying the things together that the shorter cut of the film perhaps muffled a little bit, but I think that they serve as evidence of just why the film is able to hold itself together as well as it does with all the moving parts happening in it.
I'm kind of sad though that we're going to lose Joss Whedon, because I don't know if we're going to lose some of that stuff. I mean, the guys that are coming in to do the next two, they did what, Winter Soldier?
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's going to be great, but I think there's going to be like an element of the movies that will be gone. You know, that kind of Joss Whedon thing that he does.
Maybe everybody won't sound like a snarky, quipping teenager.
Yeah, that's the only thing, because, yeah, man, holy cow. He went crazy in this one.
Like, the real strength of the Marvel Cinematic Universe in general, I think, and I've always said it, and it's something that the Warner's movies just haven't grasped, is that it's okay to actually be fun and be funny and have real moments of humor and levity, in a way that does not take away from the gravity of your themes and the grounded. If you keep your characters grounded, it doesn't take away from the gravity of the themes or the story that you're trying to tell. You can do both, you know.
Well, yeah, because one of my favorite lines in the movie is when Hawkeye is talking to Wanda and he's like, "We're at a floating. The city's floating." The city's floating. you know, that was so funny little line, but it was also a very serious point in the movie. So I think it worked really well.
But Age of Ultron does literally push it, I think, as far as it can go.
Yeah, it goes. I think that he was always, going to be a better fit, Joss Whedon, for the X-Men, because they're very snarky characters, more than the Avengers. Because when I think Avengers, you want them to have fun, but maybe they shouldn't be doing it this much, you know? They need to dial it back just a little bit. You don't need to go to 11. How about you go to 8?
You know? I mean, one of the big ways that the Avengers, the first film, is handled is, because it's like, historically, one of the things that Marvel did that was recognized as one of its defining properties that, you know, sort of kickstarted comics, or the Marvel Age of comics in the 60s, was that it treated its characters like real people who had problems, who argued with each other. And that was really epitomized in the Fantastic Four, and Spider-Man was like the teenager who had problems, and the X-Men were teenagers squabbling as well. But the Avengers weren't really those guys.
Yeah.
you know, I mean, obviously the Hulk was a problematic character for the team, and he left in the second issue of the Avengers back in the 60s. But otherwise, they kind of got on, you know. So whenever the first Avengers film did that for me, it always seemed kind of like it was paying homage or service to the bigger ideas of Marvel than to something that was specifically the Avengers, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like the Avengers didn't really do that, but it's a defining trait of the earliest super teams that Marvel created. So I can see why you're doing it here. It makes sense. And these are personalities that would clash if you choose to aim them a certain way at each other. And yeah, obviously Civil War's happening to pay that off as well.
Yeah, I never thought of it.
I had a point there, but I kind of forgot what it was.
You know, I never thought of it until now. But you know, as snarky as the movie is, you know, maybe that would fit more with Spider-Man. Maybe Joss Whedon.
Yeah, doing Spider-Man. God, oh my God, could you imagine? And we've had our Spider-Man allegedly. It looks like they're zeroing in on a guy now this week as well, who's like 16 or something.
It's the Ender's Game actor, right?
Yeah.
I'm quite excited at the prospect. It was never going to be Miles. Sorry, but it wasn't. It just wasn't.
I didn't think so. I would have been fine if it was.
I would have been fine if it was.
That was
great, because I love Miles.
But it was never going to be Miles.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
But what I really like is that he's an honest-to-God kid. Because it's like, that's Spider-Man's thing. He's the young guy. And all the Spider-Man movies is like, yeah, they're set in high school, or they move off, he goes to university. That dude is 30. and it's one thing if it's in isolation, but if he's going to be on a team with a bunch of other guys who are like 3 or 4 or 5 years older than him, and he's supposed to be playing 20 years younger than the characters,
yeah,
and then go, whoa. So they've honestly gone for an actual kid, and I think it could be quite a disarming experience. But I'm really looking forward to seeing how it plays out.
I can't wait to see him in Civil War.
Well, okay, maybe you and I that are the two guys who are still excited at the prospect of seeing Spider-Man in film.
Yeah, I mean, I love Spider-Man. I can forgive a lot, trust me. I have forgiven a lot when it comes to Spider-Man, so I think I will be okay.
I hope that they look at Amazing Spider-Man 2 and they see what worked, which is to say the portrayal of Spider-Man the character.
Yeah.
And they realize how widely loved that portrayal was, even if the film it was in was not very popular, and they bring that over, and I feel confident that they will.
Yeah.
But we'll see next year.
We will see.
Yeah. So we got rambly at the point at the end there, but Age of Ultron. My final thought on it being, it tries really hard. It's just got a lot of stuff happening in it. Just manages to hold itself together with some themes that don't seem to appeal to a wider audience, but it's still tons of fun. It's just probably generally not quite as successful. It's not as successful as the first one, because they're two very different kinds of films, but the stuff that this film sets out to do with the characters that it does it with is the sort of stuff that just excites me more. So I would have to say I probably enjoy it more than the second one.
Yeah, it's good. It's not my favorite Marvel film, but you know what? If they just stay consistent, I mean, maybe that's fine. I mean, they don't have to all be Guardians of the Galaxy and Winter Soldier, and
yeah, I mean, like, you know. There was an incredible 1-2 punch that, yeah. I mean, 2014 is going to be the year that they are held up against.
Yeah.
And Winter Soldier followed by Guardians. Oomph, oomph, total KO.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I saw it in 3 times in 48 hours, so I must have liked it.
I think you liked it.
Yeah, I think the casting with James Spader and Paul Bettany, I thought they did a really good job with it. Kind of sad to see Quicksilver make a debut and leave really quick.
I bet you didn't see that coming.
As far as Quicksilver goes, you know, Brian made a comment there earlier that I meant to respond to, which was that Days of Future Past did it better. They did the effects better.
I liked him better.
They did the effects better. there's probably, to be honest, like in all of Age of Ultron, never mind, just Quicksilver. I don't think there's honestly anything in Age of Ultron that's as much of a show-stopping highlight as the Quicksilver scene in Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
But he looked like butts in Days of
Future Past. Yeah, he looked awful in it. But I like the idea that he's so fast that like no he can't he gets bored easy. I like that, and that was kind of not in Avengers, is it? That's not in Avengers at all, really.
No, I mean he doesn't really get a lot of room to breathe, yeah, as a character in Avengers. He's one again that kind of falls by the wayside and sort of comes along to die at the end.
He's fine though. I mean, there's nothing.
The one in Days of Future Past isn't my Quicksilver. You know, he's an impatient, cheeky teenager instead of a sort of grumpy, holier than thou Euro trash guy.
Yeah.
And he looked like butts, like totally. Yeah,
he did.
Hey, I just wanted to say real quick that I liked the Avengers as well. It was really good. And I think it will go down as the second best Marvel movie of 2015.
Oh, wow. Well. Right.
What are you saying? Ant-Man's better?
Yeah. Are you saying Ant-Man? I'm still not even really excited for it. I'm going to go see it. I hope I'm totally wrong about it.
I hope they pull a Guardians.
I'm worried. I hope too. It's a Guardians too, and they should surprise us, but I'm a little worried.
I'm just a big fan of Paul Rudd to start with.
He's got bad history behind it. You know, it's like this is the film that we all know, even really like the casual guy who's pays attention to movie news knows this was Edgar Wright's baby for years and years before the Marvel Cinematic Universe was even a thing, and then he couldn't stick it out because, I mean, I think we all probably know it's because it's the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There are rules to be played in. There's a heavy hand from above on it, and you know, and it's like, so
that heavy hand is called Disney.
Yeah, well, no, but so anybody has there's this totally it's well within. There's perfectly ample amounts of reason to be concerned. The last trailer looked well. The first trailer was very generic, but the second trailer brought some humor in there. And outside of that, all the decisions that they seem to be making to bring the characters to screen, like, you know, the idea of making Yellowjacket a separate character and such, they seem to be like smart, straightforward, strong, like archetypical storytelling decisions, you know, because like we all know Ant-Man doesn't have a rogues gallery.
Yeah.
Yeah, Egghead and Whirlwind. You know.
See, and good casting. You know, I like the cast in it.
Yeah.
I think Paul Rudd's a good choice. I like that.
I'm not a big fan of his, so he's got to win me over.
I think that's a good choice. I like that. And it's odd seeing Michael Douglas in a Marvel film.
It is. I need you to be the Anthony. My Michael Douglas. I think you'll find that spot on.
That was pretty great.
That's pretty good, yeah. We were getting a funny voice.
It's Fanboy Versus. We've got McFeely's voices. Yay.
So, that was far too long on Age of Ultron.
Yeah, what did I say? We were going to talk about it for a half an hour.
It's got to be an hour at least. Okay, we better keep the rest of these kind of tight then. So we're just going to blitz through the other TV projects that have been coming up. We'll stick with Marvel. Daredevil. Who saw Daredevil?
I saw it all.
I saw most of it.
I did.
Yay, we all saw Daredevil. Yes, thumbs up or thumbs down for Daredevil.
I really liked it.
Excellent.
All right, moving on. Next one. No,
Melvin Potter. That's all I have to say.
Melvin Potter, yeah.
I am actually... I know I did by the end of Daredevil. I was like, fuck yeah, Daredevil, when season two. But I honestly took until about halfway into the show before I was properly engaged with it.
So they didn't get you at episode two because they got me at episode
two. Episode two was great.
That's,
I mean,
just
I liked
that one scene. I was like, all right, they got me. I don't. The next five episodes could be terrible or something.
You know, the scene that got me. What was the whole head through the car door thing? I'm like, okay, I'm sold. I'm like, I love the gore.
I mean, and you know, talking about not showing Hail to the King to children, I mean, Daredevil is absolutely categorically the first thing you don't show to children.
Yeah.
Yikes.
I love that scene.
But doesn't Daredevil kind of need to be in that world? Yeah, I mean, like, it's a
version.
Like, Daredevil's, like, a great character because there's, like, multiple versions of him. There's this, and then there's, like, kind of trying to make him a little bit happier Mark Waid while also making him dark. You know, he's not exactly totally happy with the Mark Waid stuff.
I was on with the first episode, enjoyed it into the second, but I marathoned this over a weekend.
Yeah.
I felt that I hit a lull for the middle quarter of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it was after that that I really came to understand and accept that, although I find it odd, the series was essentially a 13-hour origin story.
Pretty much,
For Daredevil, for his friends and allies, for all his major villains, for some of his biggest, most famous storylines, it's all origin. And I find that an odd choice because,
it's Daredevil year one.
You know what people say is that they're tired of superhero origin stories. And it's like, you wouldn't make a Batman year one television series. I mean, the first two episodes happen and it's like, okay, that's Matt Murdock. He's got powers. There's Karen Page. There's fucking Nelson. These are all things I recognize. And then we roll on and and we're getting Wilson Fisk and Leland Owlsley are being name dropped, but Leland's just standing there just being a guy. And I'm like, what's that? He's just a guy. Well, he's just a random old guy. And then that middle quarter is spent with a guy with no visual representation of any powers, no superhero costume. His famous weapons aren't there. There are no supervillains. And the only people he's fighting are generic Russian thugs who aren't from the comics. And my gut reaction, and again, this is just me. You'll see this shaped my opinion of Age of Ultron as well. But this is just me. My reaction was, In what way is this Daredevil? In what way is this a Daredevil show?
So you're thinking it needs more Stiltman.
Yes, exactly. That's what you're saying. but as I say, this is just the second quarter.
Yeah.
This is when I felt the lull. But because my gut reaction to that period of the show was, what makes this Daredevil? I mean, you could do a show and you could call it Batman, but it would feature Bruce Wayne with no costume, no utility belt, no batarangs.
And you got Gotham.
That was like the first half of Batman Begins, though.
Yeah.
Sorry?
But like, basically what you're describing is like the first hour and a half of Batman Begins.
Yes. Which is what I'm saying, yes. Like, but I was, and that's why one has to think of it as a 13-hour piece.
Yeah.
As opposed to 13 separate hour-long episodes, because Batman, you know, you go into the cinema for 2 hours, you get an hour of Bruce Wayne building up to being Batman. When I essentially came to properly understand that it was a 13-hour origin, I came to came to terms with the show makes it sound like I made peace with what I thought was a bad idea. But basically, as I say, marathoned the show over a weekend, watched the first 6 episodes on Saturday and the rest of it on Sunday. And basically, starting with episode 7, the stick episode on Sunday, and I was like, oh, now we're cooking. Stick, the chase, they're stone, they're clearly setting something up there. And then every single episode after that, you got Melvin Potter, you can see Stiltman's trousers in the background of Potter's workship.
I didn't see the Stiltman.
They're in there, you go back, look that up.
Holy crap, Stiltman's, I need to go back and watch that.
I just got excited that Buffalo Bill was in it. The guy who played Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs was Stick.
I did not know that. Really?
Oh, yeah.
Stick was amazing. That.
Yeah,
Stick was perfect.
He was such an asshole.
That's what I'm saying. He did great because I just pictured Buffalo Bill. Like, this is kind of creepy.
he was great. But then, like, the gladiators there. You see the design for his costume and his circuit.
I thought I saw the design for his costume. I did catch that, but I didn't catch the
circular saws are there. Stiltman's trousers are in there. Go and check it out. They start building a costume for the owl. They name drop. They make reference to Elektra. You know, suddenly the world of Daredevil is coming alive in the background.
They did Elektra really good because they don't actually say her name. They just say like, Yeah, it's like that. It's like, you know, what's going on with that girl? Didn't he take some class just to get close to her or something? And he says, oh, it didn't work out. And that was it. That was the only reference. So that was great.
Okay, so I got a question for y'all. Okay, when you first saw his black costume, the one that he wears in the whole series, was I the only one like, he looks like Iron Fist? I would love for him to hand over that costume to Iron Fist when Iron Fist comes out.
No, I didn't think of Iron Fist.
People will jump to tell you whenever you say something like that, because as I've experienced, that is specifically based on the comic that he wore in a miniseries that Frank Miller did.
Yeah, Man Without Fear.
Man Without Fear, yeah.
Fear. And my instinctual reaction to that, every time somebody would say, give him this proper costume, and they would, this is one Man Without Fear, my reaction was, I know, I don't care, I want him to have a proper costume.
Spoilers for y'all that haven't finished it yet. Well, you've seen it. I know you've seen it, Nicole, right? You've seen.
I know what happened.
It was everywhere. It's kind of hard not to miss.
I think it's the image on Netflix when you hover over.
Yeah. like spoilers, boom, there it is.
Instead of having the Man Without Fear costume, wouldn't it have been better if they'd had the yellow costume instead?
Yeah. I am not.
But the point I was making is the costume. Do we like it? Do we like the design? You think it looked good?
Yes, I think it could do with
less black. It's a little bit different.
Specifically unfinished, so
yeah,
could red it up a bit yet. But it beats Saflex certainly.
Yeah, it's more armory than I would like.
A little bit. That's one of those weird little concessions that I'm talking about, where it's like you can't have a costume. You got to make some kind of weird real world body armor concession to it. But they specifically do say that it's not finished.
Yeah.
So there's room for it to be nipped
in. So in second season, when he's fighting a bunch of ninjas, they'll teach him the art of having, less armor. Wear skin tight suits.
I mean, obviously the show can't lighten up to Stiltman would be the perfect example of the sort of thing I want on the Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
Some weirdo that Matt clocks before the friggin' credits roll.
If the first episode of season 2 is Stiltman robbing a bank and then him just knocking him out in the first scene, I would be so happy.
You know, we might actually get to see Ultron show up in Daredevil and Daredevil take him down.
Oh god, that would be the greatest joke ever if Ultron returns and then he's in 5 minutes and it's like, this time I'll, and then whack, just off screen.
But so as I said, once I'd sort of come to understand that that was the way they were approaching telling the story, and in the second half, when the Marvel Universe really came alive around it, that's when I really fell hard for the show. Took me a while. On Saturday night, after I'd watched 6 episodes, if I had been told this was coming out on Blu-ray, my response would have been, oh, I'll pass. I'll leave that hole in my collection. And of Sunday night, after all 13 episodes, it was like, Blu-ray, when? No. I did a 180 on it in the course of the second half. And some people disagree. I mean, my brother disagrees with me because he particularly enjoyed it for the non-superhero elements of it, and I'm like, I can't do that anymore in the Marvels, when it's specifically being sold to me as part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That creates an expectation, a social contract that you have to fulfill for me, Marvel.
One of the things I was going to say about it is I liked the supporting cast so good in this that I would have been fine if all of it was just Matt Murdock and doing his lawyer stuff and you never even freaking see Daredevil. I think I would have enjoyed it. Just dealing with all the crazy corruption and here's a case where you got to get this guy off, but oh, he's the bad guy, but oh, if I don't get him off, then Karen's going to get killed something crazy like that.
Funny thing, right? That's a great point, because whenever they announced these Netflix TV shows, everybody rejoiced because they were exactly the characters that fans have been telling Marvel for a decade plus would be better for television than for film. Daredevil is a character who would be perfect for because you can do exactly that. You could do a different case every episode. So then they make a Daredevil TV show, and they don't do that. One would have to hope that season two will take that approach. And I don't mean like in a wacky Alan McBeal style case of the week thing.
Yeah.
You know, it could be, I mean, there were basically.
No, no. The Alan McBeal show would be my She-Hulk show.
That's your She-Hulk. Yeah.
God, really.
Do you think we're going to get a She-Hulk in Daredevil?
Not in Daredevil. They would have to set her up somewhere first, but I mean, if
it couldn't be the character before she becomes She-Hulk.
That's just good.
Oh, yeah, well, I suppose we could have Jennifer Walters. Yeah.
Yeah, we could have her show up and just like name drop her. Just be like
the way things are moving right now. Honestly, it's like a couple of years time. Maybe we could, honest to God, have a She-Hulk TV show. Who knows?
I would love a She-Hulk TV show. If she's not going to be like an Avengers or something, which I'd love to see her in Avengers. Joss Whedon with She-Hulk would have been amazing.
Oh
my God! You talk about God, I love She-Hulk. I'm sorry. I should say.
Yeah. Of course you do. But a second season of Daredevil, you would assume, would have to steer somewhat more in that direction now that the big origin arc is out of the way.
Yeah.
I mean, plus, because I don't really know where you go for a big origin arc next. Mm-hmm. You would probably, I mean, presumably. It's funny because you would have to assume the show is made with the knowledge that, on the presumption that they might not get another go-round to stand on its own. And but what's brilliant is that there are tons of danglers left that are not stuff that if there was never any more, you wouldn't be like, oh, I can't believe that's never going to be followed up on. It's just all the little seeds are there to flower into the Owl, the Gladiator, Stiltman, if they ever want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Leland Owlsley was pretty goddamn great.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, in the first half, I was like, this is just some old dude.
Yeah.
He's not being any. Why is he not? And then, like in the second half, I was like, "You holy bastard!"
they did the thing where, like, okay, so like you know, he's been taken care of in this, but like he keeps making reference, "I'm doing this for my son."
Exactly.
Yeah, and I really liked that. I really liked that part.
Like, they start making a protective suit for him.
Yeah.
We never see it finished, and he keeps talking about how he has a son that he doesn't have in the comics.
Yeah.
Y'all know where that's going.
Yeah. We see a man flying around.
and so that's all there. But the only thing then that's really in there that feels like a very open dangler is the stick stuff, the hand stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, even I forgot about the Nobu as well. He was Fisk has all the lieutenants, and you're like, right, well, that guy's the Owl. I know that guy's the Owl. That old Asian lady is, what's going on there? You come back to that. You got the Russians and they're dead, and then the show gets good. Yeah. Literally, for me, that's the case. And then Nobu turns out to be a member of the Hand, and they never say it.
I didn't see that coming. And then when like he shows up, it's like, holy crap.
Well, you have to remember, Triplett, that this is Hollywood, and in Hollywood, all Asian people are ninjas.
Oh yes,
all Asian people are martial artists.
That's my exception. When an Asian guy shows up in Avengers 3, it's what Shang-Chi.
Yeah. So I mean, they never say it. They never say the name, but he's wearing red, and then they say later that they've taken his body to prepare it for their rituals. And I'm like, he coming back to life. I mean, I think and it seems very much that Madame Gao is set up for the Iron Fist series as well.
Yeah.
Her heroine is stamped with the, what they call the heroine Steel Serpent, and Steel Serpent is Iron Fist is arch enemy, and it's stamped with the.
See, Iron Fist is the one I know probably the least amount about. So
I literally only know this because I read Fraction and Brubaker's Iron Fist in the last 6 months.
Yeah. So that will be the show where I won't know much about the character. I know he has a hand that lights up and he...
Like unto a thing of iron.
Yeah. And that's it.
Well, the Steel Serpent is... he was the best friend of Iron Fist's father. And he was the son of the man who trained the Iron Fists. and he believed that he was destined to become the Iron Fist, but Iron Fist's father turned out to be the one worthy of the prize. But he wouldn't accept this. He had a huge falling out with him. He tried to take the power for himself, but he found that he couldn't handle it. And as we all know, the Iron Fist gets its power from the eternal heart of a dragon. But the heart is not in the dragon's body. The dragon is called Shao Lao the Undying. This is just your history section for the show. But its heart does not dwell in its body. Its heart's kept in a burning brazier in its cave, and you have to fight your way past the dragon to get to the thing and plunge your hands into the brazier, and that's how you get the power of the Iron Fist. So the way to stop the dragon is to block the life force of the heart from getting into its body, which is done by blocking the dragon-shaped scar on Shao Lao's chest. So one presses oneself against it. And that's how Iron Fist has that tattoo on his chest. That's the seared-in scar of the dragon burned onto his chest from when he held onto the dragon long enough to block the flow of life energy to make it pass out. But the Steel Serpent, Devos, he couldn't hold on. So he only has a partially burned-in dragon tattoo. And then Iron Fist's father saw what had happened to him, was like, shit, no thanks, and ran for it. And then he went back to the human world, had a son, and then the son came back to Kunlun and became Iron Fist. And then Devos became, you know, seething with resentment and hatred for the son of the man who'd once been his friend, et cetera, et cetera. He became the Steel Serpent. And Steel Serpent is the name of her heroine, and the packages are stamped with the incomplete dragon tattoo.
Oh, okay. See, because like, I was wondering, one thing we didn't get, which I figured they were going to do this, was I would think that if the first show's Daredevil and then the next show is Jessica Jones, there will be something that will reference to Jessica Jones as a lead in to her show. And I don't think we got it unless there was something I missed. Maybe that's the lead in, but it's a lead in to Iron Fist.
Have they said who's playing her?
It's Kristen Ritter from Breaking Bad, at least.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The bitch in Apartment 23.
Yeah, that too. That lasted
a whole five episodes.
Yeah. I didn't watch that one. I watched Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I wasn't totally sure about the casting when I heard it, but the set photos and everything, it's looking well. But I swear to God, I will punch God if David Tennant isn't painted purple at some point.
I think that's like an end of the season thing or something like that.
It's going to be something lame like that. Yeah. Like if someone will accidentally knock a can of purple paint over him or something.
But that's cool that they got him as a purple man.
I mean, it should be solidly creepy. You know?
Okay, so how do you think, like, people who don't know about Purple Man, how do you think they're going to react to him?
Well,
Good, bad?
I think, well, David Tennant will really help sell it. The whole key thrust of Purple Man and Jessica's relationship is that he never actually does anything to her. Like, obviously, that's the terrible fear, and the whole thing looming over it is the possibility that he gets sex under his mind.
He just takes away all power that she has, right?
He never actually touches her. He never uses her. He just holds her and uses her for other purposes. He never does that to her. Expressly not that nasty, tired cliche that's the only thing, that's the worst possible thing that could happen to a woman, so obviously that's what he did to her. They don't do that. That's the real strength it's unpleasant to call it a subversion, but the fact that trope is used so much, that's what it is. He doesn't do that to her, and it really is just the loss of her own agency and her control and herself that is what breaks her.
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see, because like he's so well known, you know, as like the fun doctor, you know, the kind of fun kind of guy, you know, and he'll be so he's a creepy character.
I really think he could play creepy well though. I think he will too.
I mean, I'm trying to think of something else that he's been.
He was in the new Fright Night. He's kind of creepy in that.
I'm trying to think. Has he done anything villainous? Like, I mean, he was. I know he was in Harry Potter, but that was kind of short.
Yeah.
But the closest thing I can think of where he's like kind of really dark is I'm thinking like Broadchurch or something, because I'm trying to think of something else he's been in, because he's pretty dark in that, but he's not the villain. He's just an asshole.
Do you know what I think is odd about Jones, though, which is the idea that she, quite a young woman, is going to be a former superhero? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure superheroes have only existed since, like, last Wednesday in this continuity.
She was a superhero for a week.
Yeah, maybe. A bad week.
Bad week. Really, really bad week.
Hey, before we get off Daredevil, though, what about Vincent D'Onofrio?
He was really good.
Oh, he did awesome.
Oh, my God, right?
I like him a lot. I like him a lot, but, like, I really didn't think of – when you think of, like, Kingpin, I really didn't think of him. That was really kind of smart casting. When they announced that, I was like, that's actually really smart. You know?
I don't know him well. I don't think I've seen any of his other major roles, but he just – he didn't quite run away with the entire series. But he picked it up and he nearly got out the door.
And I like that they slowly introduce him. Like there's these kind of little talks about him, and then there's the you don't say his name.
My favorite moment with him, because I still haven't seen the last, but my favorite moment with him is when he says, "Well, I have to get a new suit," and I'm like, "Yay!" I was so happy because I was just like, "He's not white. What's going on?"
You know that he's Dane. It's such a great build. It's like, because like they don't say his name, and then I don't remember exactly when it is. I feel it is like around the midpoint. It's like it's the Russians are still alive,
and they
start referring to him by name.
Yeah.
And Wesley says, "We don't call him by name. Tell Mr. Fisk we don't say his name. Tell Mr. Fisk that." And you're like, "Oh, you fucked up."
Yeah.
You knew by that stage after a couple of episodes that they had built to it so expertly that the danger was really real. And then he slammed that motherfucker's head in the car door.
Yes.
Yikes.
Kyle, I love that moment.
He's so great as like the calm, calculating villain, and also the just sort of rage monster kill destroying. I mean, he's both. He's so good at both of them.
But he's never quite calm. It's like, even when he's not so much calm as he is at rest.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how to describe it otherwise, but it was an observation Jeff and I both made when we were watching the show, was that he seems like he's being played even maybe a little bit autistic.
Yeah.
Bit on the spectrum. He's a bit... neurodivergent. Doesn't seem he's so wholly divorced, you know, because the way he tries to court Vanessa, it's like he read the instructions somewhere. It's like he doesn't know how to properly socially interact, and it's like he went and learned what the proper procedure was for doing it and then tried to follow it through, and is like,
here's the
weak and why, and he, yeah.
Here's the sad thing, though, is, like, the more we got of him, the more I just, like, I kind of want to see him get happier, because his childhood and all this stuff, I wanted him to kind of have a happy ending, but he's a monster. He's such a good villain, because he's so conflicted, you know, he's not the one-dimensional villain. You can't just point to him and say, like, oh, you were wrong to do this. But you know what? Daredevil, you're doing the exact same thing that he's doing. You're just doing it in a different way.
the car door is like the scene.
Yeah.
And there's a moment within that. And it goes on for so long. But there's a moment where the camera's angled from the opposite side of the car to where it's happening. And you're mostly seeing the body hanging underneath the car. And there's a moment where what is patently a huge chunk of brain swaps out and slaps on the face.
It's so graphic.
Oh, my God. I mean, and you know what's great as well is it's the way, you know, normally in these types of stories, and it's the truth even in the comics with the Kingpin. This is probably the best version of the Kingpin in anything ever.
Oh, God.
You know, it's like Vanessa, he's married to her when he's introduced in the comics, and she's not even aware of his criminal leanings, you know, and it's a sort of thing where it's like a bad man tempered by the love of a good woman. And what's so brilliant about this is she's actually as much of a monster as he is.
Yes.
You know, she sees what he is and she accepts that and encourages that.
Yeah.
And it's not that bad man torn between doing evil and doing good to try and please to try and keep the heart of his woman. It's like it's a pair of devils together.
The scene where like it shows him doing the same thing every day. He gets his cufflinks, he gets his suit and everything, and then it changes and she's there and she's helping him pick out everything and and she's just inserted into his life. And it's like she's always been there. It's almost like she's always been there.
It's like the cufflinks are the specter of his father, and it's not the specter of his father driving him anymore. No, it's her by his side.
Yeah,
he didn't totally run away with the show. But I mean, the urge is to have him back on your screen immediately, but you probably don't want to do that and just make Kingpin be like the only arch baddie Daredevil can have. You know,
give him a little time, have Daredevil do some other stuff, and then bring him back, and you'll love it even more when he comes back.
Yeah. Oh, man, I'll watch it again now I'm sitting here talking about it.
It's really good.
I've got to finish it.
We move off of Daredevil then. I think that's enough on Daredevil. Yeah. Name a TV show quickly.
Flash.
Yes, let's talk about Flash. I just watched all Flash in the last month and a half.
So what'd you think?
Flash is pretty darn diddly-doo darn great.
It's great. I love it.
I had to get the bad taste of Smallville out of my mouth before I watched Arrow. And then I had to get the bad taste of Arrow out of my mouth before I watched
Arrow's not as good as Flash, but good Lord, it leaps and bounds better than Smallville.
Yeah,
they've learned a lot.
Smallville after season 3.
They've learned a lot.
I quit on Smallville. I give Smallville a couple of seasons there.
At least in Arrow, he's actually a hero and out there doing stuff, and it's not saying like, oh yeah, you know, he's just a guy in a jacket. And he might fight a villain for like 2 seconds. And he might look like.
Let's not talk about Flash. Let's talk about Arrow. The first season of Arrow is pretty white people having problems and attending parties.
Yes.
Oliver's back. Let's have a reunion party. Oh, it's the family Christmas party.
He's a rich white man. I agree with that.
Occasionally. You want to go to a club? Let's run a club. I could run a club. Let's have a party at my club.
Let's put the Arrow cave underneath that.
Why don't you run my club? And occasionally somebody might get shot with an arrow.
Let's put the Arrow cave underneath that.
I got a question. Is his sister still like the main focus of everything?
I gave up on Arrow halfway through season 2.
That's why. Because I cannot stand her.
I stuck out season 1 because everybody kept telling me how much better season 2 was.
I liked season 2 better than season 1. I think if you would have stuck it out, I think you might have enjoyed season 2.
I got up to the Clock King and I fell asleep during the Clock King episode. I couldn't be bothered watching any more of it. And you know, it's not the reason I stopped watching it, but stop calling it Mirakuru. It's Miracle. You're just pronouncing it like the Japanese would pronounce it. It's an English word. Shut up. And, you know, I mean, I think the flashbacks had officially done my hash in at that stage because it was like, stop trying to be lost. The flashback ceased to have purpose. As soon as he got off that island, you broke the premise of him being missing and marooned on an island for 5 years.
I like the flashbacks in the first 2 seasons. This season, season 3, they got bad.
Now, if I understand it, this is whenever he's recruited to work for Argus or something.
So, like at the end of at the end of season 2, he does get off the island. Waller takes him off the island and recruits him to do something in Hong Kong. The entire season 3 is in Hong Kong, McFeely.
Yeah.
For the flashbacks. So
what I've heard about
Manu Bennett was pretty excellent across the board. And, you know, something I always held up about Arrow was that his costume was always great, except for the grease paint mask, but they fixed that.
They fixed it.
It didn't look like a shitty TV budget version of Green Arrow. It looked like if you made a film of Green Arrow today, that that's still the costume you would get. And I'll say the same about the Deathstroke outfit. They did a bang-up job on that, too. But season two was when it really fell into that Smallville trap of shitty TV budget versions of DC characters. Mm-hmm. Instead of Solomon Grundy, you know, instead of famous undead monster zombie Solomon Grundy, what if we had a man who was a bit strong?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Instead of Brother Blood, cultist, you know, who gains his powers from an ancient prayer shawl and has his own
he's a crazy guy in a mask.
He was a city councilman who wore a mask.
Yeah.
No, just fuck away off. Like, seriously. You know, and then
maybe you would like season three better then. Now I think about it.
Nobody says anything good about season three.
Yeah, I mean.
Laurel's awful.
Yeah.
It's like DC television programs, and one worries that one is being misogynistic, but all the women are awful. All the female characters in all these DC television
programs. Lost her name. Caitlin.
Except for
Flash is good.
Like her. Iris could go away with Oliver's sister and to an island and just never come back, and that'd be fine.
Flash is not the biggest criminal in that regard, and it's not really Iris's fault. It's the show's fault around her. But Thea's terrible.
Yeah.
Laurel is the worst.
Yeah.
Laurel just exists. In season one, Laurel exists to be a Black Canary fake out. Her name is the Black Canary's real name. They skirt around the idea of them being romantically attached. And her sister turns up alive in season two, and that's it. Laurel's usefulness as a Black Canary fake-out has ceased to be, so she is just rotated through a series of eye-bleedingly terrible subplots.
She's an alcoholic, and then, it's bad.
And now they're finally going back to it and fixing it in season three, what they should always have done with it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh my gosh! The more I'm hearing about this, the more I'm just so glad I missed out on it.
I mean, like it's this thing.
Like,
where...
Let's not even talk about Barbara and Gotham until we get to Gotham.
Yeah. So it's like this thing where maybe I am enjoying it because Smallville was so bad. maybe Smallville was just so awful and so terrible that like just to watch a show and see heroes running around fighting villains and it not be this guy who is going to just do something in the last 5 minutes and this villain who might look like Darkseid for 5 minutes. You know what I mean? Because like, you know, there was a whole season where he looked like Deathstroke, you know, in season three, there's a dude that looks like Ra's al Ghul, you know, it's not like for 5 seconds, he looks like Ra's al Ghul, you know? Maybe you're watching the show and you should be pretending that he's Batman because he basically is Batman, you know.
I mean, part of this is sort of symptomatic of DC's larger handling of this, and it bleeds into Flash too. Is like, whatever happened to the idea of the vigilante actually being the lone vigilante?
Yeah,
you know, Oliver
was season one.
You know, with season one, he's got Diggle, and that's Diggle's basically his Alfred, and that's okay. It works. Diggle hangs back. He goes out in the field and has it. Then it's like more and more and more people keep getting added to his little support network. Now,
by season three, it's the Bat Family.
Yeah, that's true. That's like there is a Bat Family, and that's what they're doing. I mean, they're just doing Batman with arrows.
Mm-hmm.
But that decision, I don't really hold it against Arrow at all. Actually, it works well enough for Arrow. But the decision to play the solo vigilante like that definitely bled into Flash. And although the characters are all quite likable, it does aggravate me in Flash that he has a huge network of civilians who all... Well, you know what? We'll get to Flash in a minute.
Arrow's not perfect, but I still enjoy watching it. I will continue to watch it. I mean, it's...
I'm going to watch it until his sister is gone.
Well,
really, I despise that character.
Don't watch season three because
I know what happens to her.
Okay,
someone told me that
she season three she's, and her hair is dumb.
She's, I guess, she's finally becoming Speedy, and I'm like, no,
yes,
she's no Speedy.
She's
that is not Speedy. Stop calling her that.
she might be the main character of the show in season.
I know.
I don't know.
I've heard that. Okay, spoiler alert for the last.
It's a show called Arrow, but
he's not going to be in it. He's not going to don the green. He's not going to don the green and black anymore. He's gone bad. I'm like, ugh.
No, it's beyond that. Are you talking about the stuff with Ra's?
Yes.
It's beyond that. It's a show called Arrow, and in season 4, there might not be an Arrow.
I know.
Maybe that's Arrow, finally. I know the show has successfully managed to move beyond it, but one of the big stumbling blocks in season 1 was the abject embarrassment at the notion of being based on a comic. It's something DC are slowly but surely managing to show. Flash has cast it off and run, you know. But
literally.
Literally. And Arrow is still dragging itself out from under a little bit. It's almost there. And the thing that I will just never forget and never forgive from season 1 of Arrow is when they're at a dinner party. And they haven't even named him the Arrow yet. He's still the Hood or the Vigilante at the time.
Yeah.
John Barrowman's character says, before we know he's evil, says, we need to give him a proper name. What about Green Arrow? And Oliver looks up with a big, dumb, dry look in his head and goes, lame. And I'm like, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, table flip, I'm done. Stop.
I was the same way, like when like this show comes out and it's like, it's Arrow. It's like, it's Green Arrow. No, it's Arrow. You know, and I was like, why? Huh? I mean, because like this fall, we're getting a show that's called Supergirl. It's not called Girl.
Yeah.
It's called Supergirl, you know?
I mean, it's like, you know, every time that, I mean, do you know, like the Flash had to skirt with it as well. What was it? It was the Streak. For a while in the Flash. And you know what was really dumb? It was like every episode started with, my name is Barry Allen, and I am the fastest man alive. There's this weird little vocal hiccup whenever he says that. Yeah. But I am the Flash, previously on the Flash. The Streak was cited in the... God damn it! Hurry up and give him his name! You know, in every episode going, the Flash, the Flash, the Flash, the Flash, this nameless vigilante...
I guess it's just they want to ease people into things. It's like, hey, maybe if you watch this show and you don't
there's easing them into it, and then there's it's the frigging name of the show.
I know. Exactly. So they should have called the first episode The Streak.
That could have been.
Yeah. Then rebranded it in episode. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's something like, you know, we're seeing it with the Ant-Man trailer coming up. They're poking fun at the name.
Yeah.
But that's, it's done in a good-natured way.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what it is. And it's going to be, before the end of it, he's going to have embraced the identity and they'll turn the joke around and he'll be proud to bear the name. That's the way it'll go. But all we get out of season 1 of Arrow is, haha, the comic book's name is stupid.
Yeah. I would just like it if at the end of Ant-Man they actually call him Giant Man.
Well, I mean,
if that's not how it ends, that's going
to digress. Like, surely, yes, the final scene, the final scene
of
Ant-Man.
What's this button do?
What does this button do? Reverse switch, you know? Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's like the villain's maybe got him beat. The villain has never thrown the technology in that direction before. Michael Douglas has equipped him with something. Because the gist of this is that Michael Douglas invents it. His unscrupulous partner slash apprentice steals it. Yeah. Goes off.
It's Iron Man.
It is basically. Makes military applications with it. Builds his own company. Steals it. And then, you know, and so then Michael Douglas needs Paul Rudd to steal it back for him. And then as the inventor of the technology, surely you would assume that the idea is that Michael Douglas gives him a secret weapon, which is the ability to grow, which the baddie doesn't have. So whenever he thinks he's got him, you know, done, click, grow, boom, boot, meat face, like, and he's stomped.
I would be great with that, but you know what I would be even better with is he beats him without it. And then at the end of the movie, he's messing with it and says, what does this do? And that's then he grows, and then that's the last joke. It's like, well, if I would have had this, I would have won the fight easier.
Oh, that's really good as well, actually.
And then you get your kind of Guardians of the Galaxy kind of funny out of the movie. Yeah, you know, that's entertaining. I don't know how they're gonna do it, but yeah, if there is not a giant man theme there at the end of the movie, somebody has done something wrong.
Yeah, that needs to be, yeah. Okay, I need to take another break for Nature's Call. New okay. Flash.
All right.
Brian, are you still with us?
I think we lost Brian.
He's like, you guys are even too dirty for me. I'm out of here.
He's like, I have a life to live. I need to escape from this.
Well, we haven't talked for over a year over stuff. We're gonna
we're just gonna record like 5 episodes in one day. Break them up so that
we definitely need to come back and do this more often.
Yeah, I need to read comics more often. I'm so behind.
I know that's what ticks me off. When we did the show, I made sure I read all my comics that week.
It was an incentive for me to actually
exactly. And now I am like hundreds of. I've got tons of them that I have not read, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
I'm caught up on Walking Dead, and I'm caught up on Transformers, and I think that's it.
Transformers is basically all I've caught up with.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, and Jim, there's only two episodes, or two issues. Okay, sorry.
Nope. Right, Flash then?
Flash.
Flash.
Flash. Flash. Flash. Ah! Savior of the universe.
Wrong Flash, but it's all good.
Savior of television. Savior of DC's televisual department.
Exactly.
I have exactly one thing to say against Flash, and it's what we were saying before, and I'll say it now to get it out of the way, and it's not Iris, but the handling of Iris's role in the TV show. And it grows out of what I was saying there about Arrow,
mm-hmm.
which is that Barry has basically, literally every friggin' character in the TV show except Iris knows his identity. Every main character knows it. And they don't all know it at once, but it's periodically revealed over a fairly short space of time. And it's like, what's even the point? I mean, I remember the point where I really lost the head over it was where he goes to get pizza for Dr. Stein and his wife. And the wife's answered the door. And there's been no indication that Barry's identity or anything has been revealed to this woman.
Yeah.
And he just booms off to get pizza. And I'm like, Barry, for Christ's sake. It's a secret identity. But I don't blame you for not knowing. Because, oh, Jesus, like 75% of the villains find out.
Yeah.
And it and basically, the show wants to do the network of civilian supporters thing. And supporters and friends helping him because they don't want to do the lone vigilante for whatever reason. Who knows? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Whatever. But they also want to have their cake and eat it by doing the classics. I mean, and I understand why they want to do it because Flash is a very classically Silver Age driven superheroes show. They mm-hmm. wanted the classic Silver Age. I cannot let the one I love be close for fear of their safety plotline.
Yeah.
So that's where the problem with Iris comes from, because whenever you have an entire cast except her who knows, and you've got everybody talking freely about this, that, and the other, then she steps into the room, and then three people have to all look off and whistle. There's nothing is going on. It's like, oh my God, shut up and just tell her. And I was so relieved when they let her find out there towards the end of the season. It's an incredible bungling, and it makes the character frustrating to watch, but it's not her. It's just, it's her role in the show as the friggin' dumbbell who is the one who hasn't found out. I mean,
could this, I know, like you said, that's just like, it's her role, but now her role changes for season two. Does that, could that make the character more interesting, like, and how she's going to react to that knowledge and not being told, because she came off, you know, she was pretty pissed.
She is pretty pissed, but I mean, to be honest, because this show had spent 20 episodes making me get frustrated and rolling my eyes whenever she came on screen to be treated like an idiot by everybody. In the episode after she found out and she copped a tude about it.
Yeah.
My reaction was very much, how fucking dare you? you know, directed at her, where basically her reaction was, oh, the Flash is out now. The Flash is out now looking for Eddie, is he? You know, deliberately fabricating a situation where she could catch Barry in a lie.
Yeah.
But without him knowing that she caught him in a lie, purely for the purposes of making herself angrier, because Barry Allen, a human being with a job and bills, was not literally spending every living waking second out there doing that.
Yeah.
Fuck off, love.
I know. That ticked me off. I'm like, okay, you could go away now and not come back, and I would be fine.
That was the only scene where, I mean, she is absolutely, categorically, entirely within her rights to be extremely pissed off.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But she takes it out on him in a really passive-aggressive, hateful, juvenile way. That was my problem.
Well, she's worried about Eddie. I mean,
oh, absolutely. But yeah, the fact
it's going to make you emotional.
You're out there now, are you? You're out there right now. You don't even know what I'm doing to you. I'm literally doing this for no reason other than to make myself angrier at you.
Yeah.
This has no effect on you.
Speaking of Eddie, I want to be spoiled on this. I've never really read a lot of Flash stuff.
He doesn't exist in the comics.
Yeah, he doesn't
exist. He
doesn't. Okay. Again, and you can see it in the show as well. Like Dinah, to a certain extent, Laurel, pardon me, he exists for about the first half of this show to be a reverse Flash red herring.
Yeah.
Because Yabard Thawne, Eddie Thawne. It's the same with Tommy Merlin, even in season one of Green Arrow. And then whenever they reveal who the reverse Flash is, which, let's be honest here, is abundantly friggin' clear from the first episode of the series.
Well, I don't think they were trying to hide it. I don't think they were trying to hide it.
Well, the thing about that is I didn't know, I knew that he had to have something to do with it. Would it necessarily have to be him?
Yeah.
Or are they establishing, because they've already established that there's time travel involved. Maybe he hasn't become him yet. Or maybe it is Eddie and Eddie hasn't become him yet. You know, there's all these questions I had throughout the whole season. It's like, so what is this? Is it maybe the reverse Flash, he exists, but he doesn't exist yet because he hasn't, like, he will not be given life or become, you know, something until the end of the season. You know what I mean? See what I'm saying with it? I mean, that's one of the things I really like about the show, the kind of what's going on, you know, what are they going to do next here?
And I mean, even in the mid-season, you had what appeared to be Wells and the reverse Flash existing in the same place. So,
yeah.
Although they never said that Wells was the reverse Flash. They just strongly hinted that there was more to Wells than appeared.
He's keeping things. Yeah. He's not telling them everything.
To be honest, it was probably only the nerdly minded who remember Hunter Zolomon, you know, the reverse Flash who was in a wheelchair, that made us really think that it was him, you know. And also the fact that he had knowledge of the future, and as nerds, we know that the reverse Flash comes from the future, whereas the casual audience who don't know that the reverse Flash is a time traveler normally, and who don't know Hunter Zolomon, that may not necessarily have gone, aha, from the very first episode. Because the thing is, you find out Wells is the reverse Flash in the same episode that they appear in the same place. But after that, Eddie falls out of the show until about four or five episodes before the end.
Yeah,
because there's nothing for him to do anymore. He's not he serves no purpose as a red herring anymore. So he just plop out of the show until Thawne puts eyes on him.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'll be asking the same question. So go ahead and ask it.
Do you think it was a smart thing to bring in the reverse Flash as the villain to begin with?
Oh, categorically, absolutely, brilliant choice. Oh, yes. I mean, the idea that the reverse Flash is responsible for Barry's mum's murder is a very recent idea that Geoff Johns created a year before the New 52 happened. Yeah. But it did intrinsically tie the reverse Flash into Barry's history. And it was absolutely the perfect choice.
What I was going to say is, so
I don't like your man that's playing him very much, though. His brother from Scrubs doing a bad William Shatner. He just sort of takes his way up to the end of sentences, and then he carries on into the next one. He delivers every monologue. Fear, compassion, power, these are the things that put me in this chair.
Yeah. Well, the thing I was going to say, so you said that the Eddie is the red herring, and that's all he is, and he serves no more
for
purpose.
Nerds. Yeah.
So, no, I mean, like, for, like, okay, so, like, what I'm saying, or what I'm asking is, so if Wells dies or something, like, something happens to him, is Eddie going to be the new Reverse Flash? Because that's where I think they're going with it. I think that, and then he becomes sort of like the Solomon-esque.
Yeah,
kind of Zoom version of him. He's not from the future, but like he maybe does something to him, or he leaves all of this to him because he already planted seeds of, yeah, you should hate Barry because look, he's going to marry Iris.
Yeah.
That son of a bitch, he's going to marry Iris. Are you going to let him do that? You know, he's done that, you know, and those seeds are planted in his head now. He's very much changed from his time he spent with Wells.
There's a lot to be revealed about Wells yet, because principally we don't know why. We don't know what the origin of his feud with the Flash is.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing I thought is that the character, it's not just the wheelchair. I mean, the character contains huge chunks of Hunter Zolomon in that his big driving purpose is to make Barry be a better hero.
Yeah.
And he doesn't do it through doing horrible things the way Zolomon does. But that was Zolomon's thing, was always that he would make better by being a villain for him. He would make Wally a better hero.
Yeah.
And they warp
all those ideas instead of it to make him a better hero. It's he needs him for something. Like he wants to get home, but he can't. He needs Barry. Well,
he needed it to happen earlier. He needed the particle accelerator, so I don't know exactly why that would be, but it makes it seem like he creates the particle accelerator in order to turn Barry into the Flash, because as we as nerds know, Thawne's reverse speed force is just a byproduct of him draining off Barry's speed. Mm-hmm. So I presume the idea is that he needed to create Barry, you know, and to push Barry to be better and to master the extent of his powers so that he could then tap them to if not restore his own. Because it's not really clear, you know, what the extent of his power. Well, then we saw that he was like charging himself with his wheelchair or something.
Yeah.
Presumably using Barry's
power. He would put that device on the suit whenever he would go into a secret room.
Yeah, the tachyon transporter.
Yeah.
So there's lots of interesting stuff happening there. And, you know, outside of Thawne and everything, is like supervillains, code names, weapons, fire, costumes.
Captain Cole has a parka.
What, oh my gosh, Captain Cole is like the cheesiest character in
Hollywood. Oh, he's
awesome. I love him.
I love him.
Why would I work with you? He is just, the suit. Scenery isn't bet.
He is chewing up the scenery. I'm not kidding.
I like him a lot.
He is making that a meal.
I told him at the very start because I wasn't sure what way they were going to play him. But as they've gone on, the idea of him being just like a blue collar smash and grab criminal who loves his town and loves to rob it has really.
But yet he's still smarter than everybody else he fights. Like everybody else has something that he can exploit and then he can maybe defeat them with it. Like, this guy, you know, he's really neurotic about this, or this guy does this. Cold's different. Cold's got it all figured out, you know. Yeah. He knows what he wants to do and he does it, and he doesn't let anything else affect him. Like, the last episode, he plays Barry. Man, he plays him. He does it really well.
What I like about him in particular is, and it's symptomatic of the rest of the show indeed, I mean, and obviously just, this is not the Marvel Cinematic Universe where the idea of superheroes having like names for the kids in the marketing and everything is a thing, or code names or whatever. So they have to work these in. And so Cisco is the guy who creates these amusing code names for everybody. What I love, and what is like a part, what will be a key sort of step in the evolution of the idea of the superhero and the super criminal, is that Cold is like, I like that. And he takes it and he owns it and makes it his own. And he's not just, Captain Cold is not just the hilarious name that Cisco refers to him with and that the hero is, that's what he calls himself.
Yeah.
And that's great.
It is great. We got an episode with Gorilla Grodd on a Flash TV show.
I would never think I would ever see that character on TV.
Yes.
Me a couple of years ago that I was going to get a live action, and I mean like a proper Gorilla Grodd, like not some boiled down TV version of it where there was an angry gorilla named Grodd that needed to be rounded up and put back in the zoo or something.
Maybe it's a kind of evil,
super strong, telepathic, talking gorilla in a series.
That was the thing where I was like, all right, the show has been great before this, but when that happened, I was like, they could do anything on this show, and it would work.
I mean, like there are certain tiers, and it's like, you know, in the same way that there are certain things that you'll just never get away with in film or in TV with some superheroes, and the hidden alien city of hyper intelligent gorillas in Africa is never going to happen. So, you know,
there's a season 2 coming, so he's got to go somewhere. So.
I mean, and the big thing, obviously, is that they don't nab him either at the end of the season. Like, he goes free. So who knows where Grodd will strike next. What about when he caught the super speed punch, eh?
Yeah, that was
awesome.
It's like, oh, God, he's going to mess him up. Nope.
That's a gorilla.
Yeah. Boom.
Oh my gosh, great. I still can't believe that they actually brought
what
him
I
in.
Really, really want when season 2 comes around is, it's the pettiest of complaints after having got a proper, full, talking, telepathic, evil, super strong gorilla. I would like him to become, because they play with it, about how he's becoming smarter, and you see on the walls how he's been doing equations and things. I want the Frankenstein speak to stuff. That's all. I want them to rock Powers Booth in there and get the Grodd voice from the cartoon in there. No, that's David Sobolov, actually. Depth Charge to you and me, Transformers fans.
Yeah,
oh, really?
As the voice of Gorilla Grodd. But I want them to just drop the Hulk talk and have the full evil scheming super smart Gorilla Grodd.
There's
a few weird touches here and there. It's like with the Weather Wizard, they give him the powers instead of the wand, and it's like, okay, I see what you're doing with the show, you know. But then they introduce the wand as something Cisco makes.
Yeah,
and then it's the same as like they don't give Grodd his little telepathic helmet, but then they do have the helmet, but it's something Cisco made.
Yeah,
so I'm like, what's that about?
I don't know.
I like to think Grodd will find that and wear it, just because.
And then
that would be awesome.
We'll grab the wand and just start using it too.
Well, I don't know why the Weather Wizard would use the wand, but Weather Wizard was always my suggestion for the baddie of any kind of first Flash movie.
Yeah.
Because my position was always that you could make, you could do the whole thing where from the comics where the two brothers, one of the brothers invents the wand,
mm-hmm.
and then the two brothers fight over it, and the idea would be that the wand would be activated and rage out of control while they wrestled, and the uncontrollable storm that it would create would then be the source of the lightning bolt that would give Barry his powers.
Oh God! Okay. Well, yeah, also,
and they got very, very close to that because they did use the Weather Wizard for the first baddie, and I mean, and they used the plastic sensible, just like elegance. Running backwards around a tornado to unspin it, and it's like, yes,
yeah.
1,000 yeses. This is just perfect. This is why you use that villain. It's an incredible feat of super speed, but it's still based around simply standing and running. You don't have to upgrade his powers to anything ridiculous. Not when I say ridiculous, I don't mean, because obviously they've progressively done the various comic book Gardner Fox Flash powers of creating gale force winds by vibrating his arms or shifting his molecules to go through walls or stuff like that. But they had to periodically work up to them. So the first big feat that he has in the series is just he has to run extra fast backwards around a tornado. I really don't have anything to say against the show except the way it's handled the Iris plot. Also, because whenever scenes involve, I mean, and I'm not very. I mean, obviously, there's always a certain element of these tragic romances in this Silver Age superhero stuff. But anytime he's sitting in that fucking wicker chair, wood paneled picket fence, three bedroom, stereotypical Gilmore Girls friggin' house, and looking wistfully off into the distance while Iris.
it is a CW show.
CW show, exactly what I was going to say. The CW-ness
is way more in Arrow than it is in Flash. They pull back a little bit more in Flash. Yeah. Maybe that's why it's better.
Maybe Legends of Tomorrow looks like it could just kick that to the curb entirely.
If it could just be the show where it's just not CW as heck, then that would be great. It's like, hey, we're just going to have Time Adventures and fight Vandal Savage. Yay!
On television. That is a thing that is happening on television. Can you believe this shit?
You know, I was happy that Vandal Savage was in a Justice League cartoon. Now, Time Adventures and fighting Vandal Savage with Rip
Hunter. What's so great about Vandal Savage is that he's outrageous and like one of the big DC baddies, but he's totally doable on a TV budget.
Yep. He's a great villain.
Looks like it could be a very effects heavy show, so who knows what way it'll go with Hawkgirl and Firestorm and the Atom finally shrinking.
And it's just so crazy to see these budgets, because Grodd looked really good on the Flash.
Grodd looks really good.
I was surprised by that. I was like, did they just blow their entire budget for the season on this one episode? And then I think, throughout the season, the FX was fine for the rest of the season too.
Fire and ice guns and speed lightning.
It's we're just living in a new age. It's an amazing time.
Slack, top tier, really. Yeah.
Can't wait to see the season finale.
That's Tuesday, isn't it?
Tuesday. Yep.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Because I really don't know where it's going.
Yeah.
What about DC's other TV offering at the minute, though? Gotham.
All right, yeah, I like Gotham. It is not perfect. It is really dumb. But the fact that it is like we were saying before, just two cops, not great
terrible,
cops,
terrible cops. Because it's not procedural. They try to make it that each episode is kind of like a case, but they solve cases by essentially tripping over a clue.
Yeah,
or some character comes along and just hands them here. Go here.
Two terrible cops in the worst city in the world. And I like it. And
the dialogue is 90% winky nods towards Batman canon.
But the actors are good. I really like a lot of the actors.
Grow a mustache, Jim Gordon. But I like a lot of the actors.
I watched one episode of it and I was just done.
I have watched all of Gotham. Gotham is garbage. It is highly entertaining garbage.
At least you didn't say it was hot garbage.
No, it's not. It's really dumb. There's no logical sense of narrative flow or escalation. Dumb shit just happens from episode to episode. The primary question hanging over the season is, when are we going to stop wasting your time with Fish Mooney?
Oh, she's done.
She is the character who's there as like someone for Penguin to overthrow.
Yeah.
But once they kick her out, like around the mid season.
Yeah.
Oh, the doll maker stuff.
Yeah.
Trash.
Yeah.
Didn't come to anything, didn't mean anything, just something for Jada Pinkett Smith to go and be in.
Hey, Batman's got a villain named the Dollmaker. There you go.
Yeah, that's it. That's your thing, you know. The finale, to be honest, even by the standards of enjoyable garbage of Gotham, I did think the finale was pretty bad. It wasn't a good finale. It was a collection.
There was nothing big about it, because you knew the thing with Fish was coming, because she'd even said, "I ain't coming back for the second season." And I was like, "Well, fine,
Brilliant killer. Let's get this over."
And so, I thought it was kind of funny that the way she played the character, she was like '60s Catwoman, You know?
Yes, she kind of was. It was
And it was funny and it was kind of cute, but you know.
Slipping in between Vixen and
well, Penguin, my baby.
Foxy Cleopatra, you know? Yeah. It was like, let me tell you something. I ain't looking for no girl.
Yeah. it is what it is, but like, yeah, I'm glad that character's gone and
you know, what was the deal with her Road Warrior get up in the final episode?
I think they wanted to show that she didn't die from that gunshot when she was escaping the Dollmaker. Yeah. And it's like she's back. Look, she's the Road Warrior. She's Mad Max.
Fish Mooney, Fury Road.
She's
far from the worst female character in the show as well, because this is the television program starring Barbara Keene.
Oh my God, that has been the worst.
Possibly the worst female character on television today.
What were they thinking when they did this? Because
I'm not even talking about what happens in the finale.
That yeah, I'm talking about the whole season.
Terrible character throughout the entirety of the season. Jim, you never share. Jim, I can handle it, Jim. Jim, you shared and I can't handle it. I'm away to be a lesbian.
Yeah.
She
loves Jim, but then she loves Montoya. And then she loves a serial killer. And now she's a serial killer.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
Yes.
Say lesbian because obviously bisexual. Don't want to be guilty of bisexual erasure or anything. And it's quite a coup in any regard to have such a prominent and open bisexual character visibly moving between relationships with different genders on a freaking Fox primetime television show. But
it comes off as garbage.
It's so terrible. Like I mean, you know what I didn't realize, but Jeff pointed this out to me. He's like, what happened to Montoya and Alan after that?
They disappeared. I don't know why. I didn't realize
they completely disappeared out of the show.
they are police for Gotham, aren't they?
Real police. They're the ones who are doing stuff.
So where did they go? Did Falcone murder them or something? I don't know.
Oh my gosh.
The show just it the thing about Gotham is the first couple of episodes were they were a real tonal mess. You could see was it trying to be a police show? Was it trying to be a superhero show? And if it was trying to be a superhero show, was it trying to be something more like Arrow, or was it shooting for the sort of lighter, campier touches of the 60s Batman TV show with villains like the Balloon Man or that senior citizen who doped himself up on Venom?
It was trying to figure itself out while not getting canceled.
But then it did not in any way figure itself out and stuck to that complete tonal mess right the way through the season. I honestly have to admire it for that, and it's kind of why I came to get into the vibe with it and stick with it, because it's just sheer bullheadedness. It was like, do you want to be this or this? And it just put its head down and it went no, and just charged forward regardless, taking on no criticism in any way, just with dialogue that was so like so many feeble winky nods at what we know. Part of coming Batman canon.
The only thing that I know about Gotham is that Greffy, he said it's the sandwich of the week show. There's always like someone eating a sandwich in that show.
They are pups. They gotta eat all the time.
But like Barbara Keene is truly, it's not a good show, but she is. Killer. I don't know where that means Jim Gordon's kids come from, but killer. She is. I mean, she was already an unsalvageable mess of a character, but if she hadn't been, would have done it.
I think his kids come from Leslie Tompkins, is what I'm thinking. this universe, it's Leslie Tompkins.
You know, my initial reaction to the idea of pairing Leslie Tompkins and Jim Gordon off was like, they shouldn't be around. She's more like Alfred's sort of age. But then it's like, then like a couple of episodes later when she actually turns up and it's like, oh, she's going to take Barbara's place. Fucking brilliant.
Yeah, it's just... it's fine. I'm fine with that. I mean, it's
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
It's a show. All right, so you need to not think of it like as a Batman show. Because
that's the
thing is like they keep doing all the little things. Here's Bruce. He's mad. Yeah. Bruce is doing this. Oh, Bruce thinks there's something going on in his company. Oh, Bruce is trying to figure out what's it. Okay, as soon as they completely...
Bruce is 12 and nobody takes him seriously. One shot.
Bruce is cutting himself now. No one's paying attention to him. No.
Master Bruce.
As soon as they get... because I never want to see Batman in this show. I never want... Never want to see that. I want him to...
The only way you can do that is a time jump, but it's like...
I want him to go away. I want him to just say, I'm leaving. Alfred can probably stay. He can maybe help the police or something. Yeah. Somebody's got to watch the house.
Yeah, and windows aren't going to watch themselves.
But I want the kid to leave and not come back. And I want it to just be about cops dealing with crazy stuff each week. I don't care if it becomes something more. I don't care if it does something else. I just like it like the way it is. I'm fine with that. Now,
Robin Lord Taylor is a revelation.
I like him a lot.
I mean, who would have ever thought that this TV show would be the first thing where anybody ever gave a shit about the Penguin?
And he's not... what you expect the Penguin to even look like. He's very different. I mean, he's like the slender guy, you know. He's not like a like heavy set in his look, but he's just so playing everybody, and he's so good at it.
Again, he's part of the show's tonal mess as well, because on one hand, he's gotten people personally into stealing their sandwiches and things.
Yeah.
But on the other, he's a constant quivering mess who never seems to have any kind of contingency for when anything goes wrong. And I'm like, how seriously am I supposed to take this guy as a threat?
I take him as a threat. Yeah, I think I do.
I feel like if I was locked in a room with him, I'd take him.
But he's wily, though, because, like, remember, like, there was the episode with the two elderly people and, like, at the end of it, he says, like, I got a train ticket for one of you and a bullet for the other
that
or something.
Was good. I like that.
One kills the other one, and then he just shoots her. You know?
That was the first time I legitimately thought of the Penguin as somebody conniving enough to play people openly without having to prepare months in advance.
So
I mean,
he's
conniving
and
everything. If I was locked in a room with him, he would. Now, hold on one moment, good sir. If I might perchance to make some form of conditional restitution,
I think it's all part of it.
Oh, shut up.
It's all part of it. So basically, you've got to kill him before he talks. Because if he starts talking, you're dead, McFeely. You can't let the Penguin talk. That's the kind of character he is. Once he starts talking, I think he'll take his shoe off and beat you to death with it. I don't know.
I really don't think he would. He would have trouble getting it off that weird gammy foot he has going on.
But either way, I love him. I love watching
him. He is great. I mean, he is very entertaining in the show.
It's like him, and it's like Bullock, and it's like Gordon, and then the crap that they put up with every episode. That's what I like watching.
It's like nothing.
It's like Bullock getting angrier and angrier with like all the crap that happens. Like he went to the room, the sex room, and he lost it. He's like, this is beyond what he wants or something. And he like says like calls the cops. I just really like it. I think it's a great show.
Great, terrible.
Great, terrible.
I know that say anything good about that.
Nothing in the show flows sensibly on from one. There's no sense of escalation or building to anything. It's a series of dumb stuff that happens one episode after the other. And I like it when it puts its head down and really gets embroiled in its ridiculousness. Like we have like a guy who kills people by strapping them to weather balloons, or a senior citizen scientist who does dose himself up on the prototype version of Bane's venom.
But I also do like that there's crime families, and the crime families are fighting over things. And then at the end of it, like, Penguin basically gets rid of all of them. And he's like,
and so
he owns
that's
Gotham, you know.
Kind of hiccuped for me, because it's done the Smallville thing. And I don't really want to compare it to Smallville, but it does present itself, like Smallville, as being the prequel to the world you know.
Yeah.
So it takes as read the fact that the audience will recognize Little Poison Ivy, Little Catwoman, Little Batman, Little Riddler, you know.
And he's not so little.
Not so little.
No.
probably wouldn't have too much trouble taking this Little Riddler and they get old enough to fight. And then they go and do something that makes a widely accepted sort of key element of the Batman present day mythos impossible, which is to say they remove Maroni and Falcone from play. And even casual Batman fans these days know Maroni and Falcone from the Nolan films.
Yeah.
So the idea that they've been removed from play has, okay, they're quite minor on the scale of things, but it's, so it hasn't broken the premise of it being a prelude, a prologue, but it skirts the edges of it, and it's still left open though,
where you know Falcone could always come back or something. Who knows?
But Smallville repeatedly and resoundingly broke the idea of it being any kind of prologue that could ultimately lead into the Superman story we know. Until the finale, whenever they turned around and said, no, it all totally works out somehow.
It's like we were planning it all along.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, he's already fought and defeated every single supervillain.
Wearing the Superman suit. You have to magnify in to see it, but look, he's wearing it.
Yeah, he's met all the super friends and he's beaten all the super baddies that he ever will in his career. So I don't know what it is that he actually does now that we're claiming he goes on to be part of the regular Superman setup, but yeah. But so it's only Maroni and Falco, and so it skirts the edges. But I mean, we pretty much got Nygma becoming the, you know, Jesus under Christ, undergoing one of the most hackneyed transformations into the Riddler in the finale. Like,
yep.
It's not good, but it's surprisingly entertaining in how dedicated it is to not being good.
But like, I don't think it's such a mess that it couldn't get better. I think that they could, because there's pieces that are really good.
Saying, but I think we're at a season they have drawn the line in the sand. They have said this is good. This is good enough. We are not interested. Like, all the problems that are apparent in the first couple of episodes persist until the very end. They have made the statement, we're not interested in trying to figure out what works about this show and fixing it. This is the show. So. Yeah. I think if keep watching Gotham, one simply has to take it for what it is at this stage and not hope that anything will change about it.
Yeah.
Lastly, because Jesus, what time is it? The last TV show that I think, because I didn't watch Constantine and it's cancelled now anyway.
I liked Constantine. I enjoyed it.
Constantine's good? All right. Well, I haven't watched it yet, so I will watch.
I hope that it can somehow live again somewhere else, because they keep talking like maybe they can do something with it. It ended on a cliffhanger too, for God's sakes.
I hate that.
Just like what you said, like I think last time we spoke, you plan your shows to have an ending. Don't guarantee that you're going to get a second season or you're going to get picked up. Finish your storylines. You know?
Which I think is actually quite relevant to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yep.
Which has just wrapped up this with a generally strong second season.
I liked it. I enjoyed it better than the first season.
I mean the first season was honestly the season we lied to ourselves about how good it was up until the Winter Soldier crossover happened.
Yeah.
the Winter Soldier crossover in season one brought that show to life, kicked it into high gear, and the second season absolutely maintained the momentum, going straight in as well.
Yeah.
I think for me it fell into a lull in the when it came back from mid-season in the third quarter. The two shields plot was not interesting.
Yeah.
It seemed that was just there because they knew that the Inhumans thing was the big season finale payoff, and they just did something to limp to the gate with.
Yeah. Because the guy, what's his name? Yes, I expected him to do something else, you know, to be more in it, and then it just turns out that he's not the villain. He's not the bad guy, actually. The bad guy is this person, you know.
That's the price. I mean, I don't. Well, you guys know what I was demanding from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. from the outset, and what I had a lot of problems with season one was, and I said it about Daredevil there as well, and I'm afraid I'm beyond help on this one, which is that if you are going to sell yourself to me on the, and I mean very much so, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was sold on the premise that it's part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, then I'm sorry, I require real Marvel Comics characters with powers and costumes and code names, and not the adventures of Joss Whedon's 6 made-up fan characters.
That's what it is.
Yeah, and season 2, out of the gate, was like you could sort of, if you cupped your ear, you could hear the people in behind the show going, fine. And season 2 opens with the absorbing man, yep, looking exactly like he does in the comic books, with his powers, no origin story required, and they even paid homage to his Wrecking Ball weapon. Yeah. Then Mockingbird comes along with a cool outfit. She got her battle sticks. She goes by the Mockingbird code name. Then the Inhumans start coming in.
The Inhumans you've never heard of.
Yes, okay, but
Joss Whedon created because the real ones are going to be in the movie.
then. I mean, it takes a while for it to be revealed who he is, but then it turns out we've got Calvin Zabo, we've got Mr. Yeah. Hyde, one of the main baddies in the season, who finally hulks out.
Played by the guy from Twin Peaks. Yes.
In the finale as well. And it's like, yes, Calvin McLaughlin was great.
So, he's awesome. Yeah. he was probably the best thing of this season, just because of his wackiness.
Yeah, he did play that very manically. I mean, and then it turned out that Sky was Quake from the comics as well. And they even managed to fire Angar the Screamer in there too.
Yeah.
But so with all that happening, it did then irk me, like, you know, for instance, whenever Cal puts his little team of supervillains together, he get Angar the Screamer and three made up nobodies. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why?
So far, who knows who they might be?
No, they are nobodies. Their real names aren't from the comics. So then the two Shields things happened, and it's just a bunch more characters that they've made up, and then the Inhumans that are appearing are made up as well, and it's like, and that's when the lull period hits. You know, if you're gonna clog your show out with characters and plots, because there was a real clogging happening there. I mean, that was right when Ward and Agent 33 returned, and you wouldn't really have expected them to come back in the back half of the season. S.H.I.E.L.D. sort of doesn't let go of its subplots very easily.
God, Ward is such an asshole.
I love how much of an asshole he is.
He's a great character. I think he's awesome, but he's such an asshole.
Fear off the back of season one would have been that they'd forgive him and it would all go back to basically being the same way it was throughout the rest of season one. No! He's a total asshole! And they're sticking to that, and that's really good.
And he's like, he's got it in his own head that he's doing the right thing, but like everything he's doing is just like murdering or hurting people or sticking nails in Mockingbird.
Oh my god, I had to look away.
Such an asshole. God.
Oh, God. So then the show became, like, in the third quarter, the show became very bogged down. I mean, you had the Inhumans plot the Inhumans plot and Sky's quest to discover who she was and their stuff with her parents. And that's all the same plot. But then you had the two Shields plot running side by side with that. And then you had Ward and Grant coming back as well. And it just became very bogged down. And if you're going to bog your show down, at least bog your show down with real Marvel characters who have a reason to be there and not ones you made up expressly for the purpose of bogging your show down.
I don't know. Like, some of those characters I really like, so I'm okay with that. But, like, I see what you're saying. Yeah. It's never been the show that everybody thought it was going to be. It's something else.
I think this season, post-Winter Soldier, up to about the mid-season break of this season, though, it's really been... It finished quite strongly. It was a very good finale.
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
The finale came together very strongly. Lot going on. I'm glad they aired the two parts in one go.
Yeah.
But it was a strong, strong finale. And it's coming back next year. And you know what we have? You know, I forgot it happened this year as well, but it's
Agent Carter. Part of
Agent Carter, yes, which was
great. That was so good.
Good.
And
we
that's coming
Dum
back,
Dum
too.
Dugan
I like that. I like that a lot.
We did a Howling Commandos.
I really liked, I can't think of the actor's name, but I really liked his Jarvis.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
that was my thing for this year. Whereas like last year it was like I can't believe Ronan the Accuser's in a film, and I can't believe Vision's in a film. This year was like, I can't believe I live in a time where Edwin Jarvis is on my television every Tuesday. Yeah. What a time to be alive!
Yeah.
Jarvis is
he's helping silent. Agent Carter like stop Nazis and other things.
Do not phone after 9:30 at night. What happens at 9:30? My wife and I go to bed.
Yeah. He's great. And then like I saw that actor, he was in Broadchurch season 2 playing a totally different character. I had to do a double take when I saw him. I was like, wait, what?
So there's more of that coming up, and I'm really looking forward to that, because it was just generally a very solid first season. And again, it was one that it had the advantage of the central character not being a made-up non-Marvel fan character, but whenever she was being helped out by Jarvis and working for Howard Stark with and they went out of their way to try and reference as many obscure little wartime era Marvel things as they could, the Howling Commandos, blah blah. Do you know what I didn't even realize though, and I only found out like a month or two after the fact, I did not realize that the evil hypnotist doctor was Dr. Faustus.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, there you go. You see, it was me then. No, it was
no. I caught
Dr. Faustus.
I caught the thing about the whole the initial Black Widow program and all that stuff. Yeah. But I didn't catch that's who that guy. I just thought he was just crazy Russian guy over the Black Widow program.
See, that's why I didn't really get when Toby Jones turned up at the end to be Arnim Zola. And it was like, okay, so Arnim Zola and that guy are hanging out. All right.
Yeah.
Because in Agents of and again, and I totally missed this in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as well. The method that they use to brain, that Hydra uses to brainwash the operatives, is called the Faustus method.
Oh, yeah, I didn't catch that either.
So, like, the idea was that, you know, Toby Jones recruited, I keep calling him Toby Jones, Arnim Zola. Arnim Zola recruits Dr. Faustus for Hydra, and he provides them with a method of brainwashing their soldiers. And then suddenly the two shows, I understood how they were connected more a month or two afterwards.
Man, I really hope Arnim Zola's in Civil War.
I hope so, too.
There's something. I want the robot in his...
Well, again, he needs to be in full robot form, though. I think
he's absolute, and they blew up that base. Big deal. He's totally got an out to have survived somehow.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're at a stage now, just off the back of a movie about killer robots, where the idea of taking that little screen from Winter Soldier and just putting in a robot's tummy is not going to be outrageous. It's not going to appear dumb or unfeasible to an audience, because, like the way Marvel usually is, they've slowly built a...
Maybe he'll take over a leftover Ultron body.
Yeah, something like
that. But, like, to go back to Agent Carter real quick, it's... I really like that it can be like a mid-season thing, like what they did, where it's like, all right,
yeah.
We'll take a break from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and here's Agent Carter, and then when that's done, we'll come back to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I like that. I'd like to keep doing that.
It keeps the stuff flowing, and apparently that's what they're going to do again next year.
It doesn't have to always be Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or Agent Carter. It could be other stuff, but I kind of like that. Here's something else to be doing while we take a break and then go to this. I mean, if they wanted to do it with another show at some point, that would be cool.
I just want to see Howling Commandos. I want to see them do a spinoff of Howling Commandos.
I do want more Howling Commandos.
And I like Dum Dugan. I mean, is probably in my top 5 characters of all time, and I love him.
Needs they use guys like Pinky Pinkerton was in this one as well, so I was like, oh, Pinky Pinkerton. But yeah, so I mean, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., it's a whole series, so there's a lot to unpack. But basically, I think that it's finished. It's not finished as strong as it started, but it finished stronger than it looked like it was going to after a bogged down second half.
I don't know that end. Holy crap! I want to see season 3 now. I don't know what's going on.
And see, now there's what we're talking about. This is talking about finishing your shit. It's like you take that little scene off the end.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. You know, you're pretty much you've tied
you resolved it. Yeah.
Yeah, you've resolved even the big lingering mysteries that carried over from season one, the mystery of Sky's parentage ring. That's been resolved. You're pretty good to if you know
what's
end.
Yeah,
you're done. But then wham, they slam that on the end, and I'm like, what's going on here?
So like, she's not dead, right? She's gonna become something else, right?
I don't know what, because I don't know what that stone is.
What is that thing? Because like, I was trying to think, like, is this something that maybe McFeely knows what it is? And it's like, I just don't know. Is it because it's Inhuman related? It's a something Kree related. The Inhumans were afraid of it. Is there some reference to that?
Nothing I'm aware of, but I would.
It kept changing shape, so I thought, well, maybe it's a Skrull thing. Or a Chitauri, well, it'd have to be Chitauri.
When we started talking about having a Kree artifact below decks before we saw what it was, the first place my brain went was a sentry. Because that's what the Kree leave behind on their worlds to monitor shit, is a sentry robot, you know. So unless maybe Gemma's going to get possessed or taken over by the liquid.
It needs to connect with something to become.
Yeah, and then turn her into a sentry?
She already hated the Inhumans this season.
Oh, man. She and Fitz have been two of the characters to watch this. Fitz in particular, really, I think, has been one of the highlights of the show. Because he was not particularly likable in season one. But in season two, oh, poor wee Fitz.
Yeah, I felt bad for him.
Oh, poor wee Doug. I mean, whenever he would stop, stutter, and have to try and think of a word, he'd be like, oh, poor wee Fitz. I saw a film with Ian DeCastecker in it. When was it? Late season one, early season two. He played a fairly unlikable wee dick in it too. But it's a testament to his ability to really have turned the character around performance-wise from somebody who was never really liked very much in season one into the really sympathetic wee hen that he's become in season two. He was a real highlight.
Mm-hmm.
The Sky really came into her own as well, because throughout season one she only ever really seemed like the team pet that was tagging along, but there was no question in this season
she helped him, she could hack.
Yeah. Rewrite the encryptions. I'm in.
I couldn't help but laugh in the finale where she's like, he's like, all right, you know, I need your help to stop them. He says, all right, you got to get these things off me. They're mute my powers. That's not the help I needed. And then he gets her a laptop, and I kind of laughed out loud. And I was like, all right.
Make earthquakes. There you go. For the budget. Just shake the camera.
Yeah. I need your other abilities.
Not and I like, great the, chicken I like abilities. The suggestion that they might be doing, like, the secret warriors as well.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, she said they have to gather fired people and make a team and do it off the books that would have to be done in secret.
I got that. I didn't know what they were referencing. I didn't read that, I don't think. No, I didn't read
that. Quake was, you remember, Quake was introduced in Secret Wars. No, not
Secret Wars. I vaguely know who Quake is. Like, when they started, like...
It's about it. She was one of Bandus's pet characters. Never really went anywhere.
When they were starting to point her in that direction, and I was like, oh, okay, so she's an Inhuman. Who is she? Where are they going with this? Like, I knew they were all made up, but like her, and then I heard, it's like, oh, she's Quake. And I was like, okay, well, that's nice, but you said she's not made up. And I was who is that?
It's like, I don't believe for a second that was the original plan when they started the series. Yeah. I don't even really think they knew who her dad was when that bloodied hand appeared at the end of season one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they decided it yet. I mean, and I'm not saying that just because I'm mad because I wanted it to be Fin Fang Foom in human form, and she would turn out to
be half. Oh my gosh, that would have been awesome!
She turned out to be a baby Fin Fang.
Yeah, she turned out to be half Maklamon, and she didn't know it, and she would be like, "Oh god!" And she would turn into a dragon. It would be awesome.
Oh my gosh, I would have loved that.
Put Fin Fang Foom in film, Marvel. Come on, seriously. You give me Ronan, Ronan.
I was joking about that the other day with some of my friends, and they didn't know who he was. I'm just like, he's a dragon. And they're looking at me like, whatever.
Oh, no, you see, he's an alien dragon, and you need to...
I forgot to put that. Maybe they would understand if I said
alien. Did you mention the purple underwear?
I did.
Oh, well, okay, you're doing
well, because they looked at me really funny. I'm like, well, did I mention he wears purple shorts? And they're like, what?
Is there any chance that Fin Fang Foom can be the major villain in Doctor Strange? Please let it please.
I'm not saying I don't want Vin Fang Foom to exist immediately, but that seems like a job for Dormammu.
Is there any chance he could be the villain of Black Panther?
Just making the villain an Ant-Man and go from there. Maybe he could be the villain for Captain Marvel. Guardians
there
of the
you
Galaxy.
Go.
Guardians of the Galaxy would work.
Yeah, they could put something in there.
I mean, it's a jokey concept, and that's a jokey movie, so... He's got a diaper on, it's purple.
Purple. Well, I think that's all the TV and films from the last year. So to round it out, then, do we wanna say drop a few comics recommendations? What have been this is a comic show after all. What have we been reading lately?
I haven't been reading hardly anything. It's pretty sad.
I've been reading. Well, a Gem just started.
Gem's yes, awesome. I haven't read Gem properly, but I hear very.
The third one comes out this week, so it's only three. You can catch up really easily. They've changed the whole. Well, it still's got the same fun feel of the characters, but
Gem the cartoon, right? Gem,
yeah,
okay. And not like Gem the movie trailer that was terrible.
No. No, but
truly outrageously terrible.
Truly, truly terrible.
Yeah.
They have like different body types now. They even have a lesbian on as one of the main characters, and so they're branching out and they've got a new like origin story for him. But it still works, and it's a really
fun. Is the Misfits still trying to like mess them up?
Oh, the Misfits are great.
Okay, there you go.
But
just as crazy as usual.
Better.
Of course they are. Okay, this is what's brilliant. Because I was thinking, I'm like, how are they going to put music on the page? Now, this is John Barber's little baby. Okay. When he became editor of IDW, he pushed for a Gem comic since day one. Because that's what he wanted. And so I'm like, well, how are they going to put the music on the page? And it's beautiful how they do the wording. And it looks like... how you'd picture fun music would be. It's really fun. And another comic that I think is really good is Wayward.
Wayward.
I don't know.
Yeah. The gal that works at the comic shop, she's like, you got to read this. Basically, it's about a girl who's half Irish and half Japanese, and she decides to go live with her mom in Japan. And So she's kind of the awkward element in the story, but all this Japanese supernatural stuff happens. So if you're really into some crazy Japanese stuff, there you go. It's really fun. Like her best friend, she didn't realize was actually, I can't remember what they're called. She morphs into a cat and is like her protector. So kind of like a familiar, but it's really a lot of fun. So those are two I would recommend.
Now, who's Wayward from?
Image, I believe.
What's the creator's name on it, Tina?
Gosh.
I don't have hard questions. I'm used to asking these questions when we have our comics.
I should know because it's one of those comics I'm so excited to get, and I forgot who does it now.
So Image is still doing some pretty cool original, awesome stuff, it sounds like, right?
Okay. Well, I really enjoy it. Those are the two comics that I look forward to. But of course, there's always More Than Meets the Eye, which we're all of us are reading.
Nope.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't like talk about anything that I'm reading because like literally the only thing I'm caught up on is The Walking Dead, which I like, and the Transformers comics, and that's it. I mean, even Spider-Man, I've fallen so far back behind on that I probably have a year's worth of Amazing Spider-Man to read. I want to read them, I just haven't had time to read them.
What about you, McFeely?
For me, I would definitely have to spotlight some of the new series that Marvel have come out with early this year so far. They're three in particular: Ant-Man, Howard the Duck, and Squirrel Girl.
I wanted to know about Howard the Duck because I was like, I need to know what McFeely thinks about that book.
So it's friggin' great.
Is it? Okay, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, the basic premise of I was a little wary. Well, basically, okay, well, well, The basic premise is Howard trying to find something steadies, somewhere to sit, somewhere to lay down some roots. Howard is a private investigator now. The proverbial private duck. he's not bringing in an awful lot of cases. He's working out of the same building that She-Hulk's got her law offices in from her series recently.
Does she still have a law office? I mean,
yeah, she's still there. She appears intermittently. She and Howard really don't get along because he's
apparently. I need to read that book since they canceled She-Hulk.
She's like Howard's only friend and the only contact in his phone, so he's the one who keeps getting called to the prison, to jail, to bail him out whenever he gets.
That's great.
That's awesome.
In fact, well, you may have done in the last issue of She-Hulk, like you see Howard.
Didn't read it. Sorry.
Behind. Howard just poked. He's looking around the building. Yeah, this will do fine. You know, he come. Yeah. So, the plot is that he's hired by a guy to recover a necklace that's been stolen by the Black Cat, and then he gets the necklace back, and then you can see the movie influence is on hand, because then one of the collector's emissaries comes and collects him. So the issue ends with Howard like waking up in a prison cell next to Rocket Raccoon, and suddenly I'm like, my instinctual reaction was, what happened to the street level private detective stuff? You know, it suddenly seemed like it was taking a big swerve away from what the premise of the book was,
mm-hmm.
In order to do something that would be recognizable as a movie tie-in. But then the second issue came out, and the whole space collector Guardians tie thing was done and over in an issue, and the issue was predominantly about Howard trying to get the necklace back from wherever the collector had stuffed it. And then when he got back down to Earth, he was calling in on the new human friend that he's made, only to find that her place of business was being held up by Aunt May.
Oh wow.
It's like every final page is a different crazy. And the third issue came out this week, and it turns out that Aunt May is only one of a series of senior citizens that the Ringmaster has been hypnotizing to carry out crimes for him.
Why am I not reading this book? I'm just gonna drop everything and just read Howard the Duck.
It could have gone anyway, but it's proven very successful. It's not the usual sort of scathing Howard commentary on the popular trends and popular culture and things like that. Not fully, not really. Not in the way that Ty Templeton's miniseries from a couple of years ago tried to capture, like what Steve Gerber did. But it's very much sort of got its own voice, and it's setting out to do its own thing, and it's doing it very well and very funny. Like the police chief knows him, because he's in trouble so much that he just sort of refuses to take on the fact that he's a duck. He just won't write it in the reports. I'm not writing that there was a talking duck in here. I mean, the scene that in this week's, I think perhaps the scene I laughed the absolute hardest at out of the issue so far was in this one, where Howard is trying to, with the help of Aunt May, who just would hate to think that she was causing trouble for anybody, and the new friend who's a tattoo artist, they are out. They're trying to. I'm getting myself mixed up. They try to find Aunt May first of all, and to find Aunt May, they like spy on the seniors at the park. And the scene opens just with a tight shot on a duck in a duck pond, and it just goes quack, quack, and the scene pulls out, and there's Howard naked, sitting on all fours, just amongst the ducks, just going quack, quack. And that's him undercover at the seniors for feeding bread to the ducks.
Oh God.
Oh my gosh!
And there's actually a really good gag running through it as well, like where Spider-Man gets involved in the first issue because Howard's going after the Black Cat, and this collector emissary comes and zaps Howard with a teleporter, but Spidey thinks he's been atomized, and he collapses over in tears, and it's like, Howard, No, 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 Uncle Ben, no. In the second issue, when Hiron comes back to Earth, Spidey's still lying, disheveled and unwashed by a little memorial that he set up in Torchmark for Hiron.
That's great.
Oh my god!
And then in the third issue, whenever Hiron finds Aunt May, has a brief altercation with her. She's on the phone to Peter at the time. He sort of accosts her, but they talk it out. They explain what's been going on. Aunt May agrees to help them, but Peter only hears the shouting that happens at the start. So, but she drops her phone and the flowers she's holding, but she leaves with Howard. And then a couple of panels later, Silent Spidey swings in and finds the discarded cell phone. Mrs. Parker, your nephew was so worried. He said, why am I so mad at this?
That's great.
It's been excellent. Squirrel Girl has also been something quite just wonderfully lighthearted, very, very funny. Just like just in a really sort of female positive, body positive, light, wonderful, young people friendly. You would happily give it to a child of any age. It's been excellent, and it's been about Squirrel Girl. Basically, Galactus is coming to eat Earth, but he shielded his ship from detection by all on Earth except accidentally squirrels. And the squirrels find out Galactus is coming and they tell Squirrel Girl, and she has to steal Man armor to fly to the moon. And
this sounds like Tiny Titans or something. You know,
well, it's a little bit. You know,
it kind of has that feel. Yeah, it's a fun.
That's cool.
And then the other one is Ant-Man, and honestly, Ant-Man is. It's only just started, really, but I think Ant-Man for me so far is a good, strong contender for Book of the Year so far.
Who's the creative team on Ant-Man?
It's by Nick Spencer, who did Superior Foes of Spider-Man, you see.
Okay.
And it's very Superior Foes of Spider-Man as well. It starts with a double-sized issue, which, you know, and I know we don't get those much anymore, and okay, that means they're $5 these days, but it's an excellent first issue that tells a complete story that sets up the whole new premise of the thing, where we see the first couple of pages of it, we see he's broken into Iron Man's apartment for some reason. It's like, oh, he's back to his old stealing ways. Then the rest of the story is about how he's kind of down on his luck and trying to find a new job. And one of the challenges set to win this job at Stark is to hack into a system or whatever. And he decides to shrink down and steal the passcodes by stuff like that. But it's really about setting up the premise about how he gives up. Scott Lang snatches failure from the jaws of victory, success.
So it is Scott. That was one of the things I was thinking about too, because like I obviously if they're releasing a new Ant-Man book and it's Scott in the movie, it would make perfect sense for it to be Scott.
I mean,
in that book.
This book exists because of the movie, but yeah. Thankfully it's not beholden to it in any way, and it's not just some clumsy, tacky thing that they farted out because the movie's happening. It's really, really excellent. Like, it's funny, like Superior Foes was. Like, he's set him, like, he moves to Miami to be with his daughter, because his ex-wife moves to Miami and takes the daughter with him, and he follows them out there, essentially. And the daughter knows and the wife doesn't, and it kind of, you know. But he's trying to set up his own security firm. And on the first day, like, the grizzly comes smashing through the shop front, and it's like, Ant-Man! And it's like, dude, who are you? And they have a bit of a fight, you know, and then it turns out that he's got the wrong he's come out.
I want to see the grizzly in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. next year.
Come after the wrong Ant-Man, so Scott offers a job, and the grizzly starts working as muscle for Ant-Man Security Solutions. And then that's they great. Go and hire the Machine Smith, the old Captain America villain, the Machine Smith, who works them as well. It's the three of them installing security around Miami.
That's great.
those are three of Marvel's strongest new books this year so far. Truly excellent.
I hope they make it, because there's been some books I really like and they don't make it. Like, I like that She-Hulk book a lot and they didn't make it, for example.
Well, everything is up in the air with Secret Wars.
Yeah.
I mean, we do not, like, we know that from all appearances, although nearly everything in the Marvel Universe Universe is stopping and being either replaced with a miniseries by the same creative team for the duration of Secret Wars, or possibly ending and then having something else Secret Warsy vaguely related happening. Some books are not being affected by Secret Wars, and those three books appear to be three of the books that are not being affected by Secret Wars. I heard Ant-Man and Squirrel Girl.
That's good.
But apparently Squirrel Girl is not selling so great, so who knows. Get out there and buy. I mean, this month's issue of Squirrel Girl, now I'll be freely admit, it didn't do it for me, because the gist of it is that Squirrel Girl's roommate, who has found out her secret identity in the course of the first couple of issues.
Did the tail not give it away?
She keeps the tail tucked into her trousers.
Okay. Because it really is her tail, right? It's not part of the costume, right?
Yeah, yeah. She really has a tail. And she
just trying to make sure.
And she has tipsy toe.
Tipsy toe is there, yeah.
Okay.
I like you. Or she, I guess.
Yeah, but tippy toe is like, you know, won't people notice a college girl with a tail? And she says, maybe, but they won't notice stuff. A college girl with a particularly awesome butt.
That's great.
That's part of the body positivity message of the book. Thank you. This month's issue is like the roommate is, because this is what the plot of the book is, that Squirrel Girl has gone back to college. That's your civilian through line of the book. She's moved out of the mansion of Avengers, the attic of Avengers Mansion, where she's been hanging since she was babysitting baby Luke Cage, whatever her name is.
I don't know the names either.
Yeah. And the roommate is being held hostage by terrorists in the top of the Statue of Liberty with a bunch of other people. And she tells them all not to worry. Squirrel Girl will be here to save them soon. Squirrel Girl's awesome. But no one else has heard of Squirrel Girl. And then they all start lying and claiming they have heard of Squirrel Girl. And they all tell different stories about what they think Squirrel Girl is. So, you know, you've seen that episode of Batman. You've seen that Batman anime movie that they made where they all do the same thing.
Oh, and it's one of them's the Dark Knight Returns version of Squirrel Girl.
Well, they do that. They do that.
Rubber bullets, honest.
It's not that it's not good, but yeah. I'm over the idea of it. So this month's issue didn't do much for me.
Yeah.
As a premise, but it's tons of fun otherwise. Like she's back in school and Craven the Hunter turns up on the campus the first day, you know.
Of course he's gonna want to hunt a Squirrel Girl.
No, he was hunting Spider-Man or something, but Squirrel Girl was like, dude, shut up, you need to go.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, they've been just three very, very successful out of the gate new books. And what Squirrel Girl is on is on number four?
Five came out.
Yeah, five came out. Yeah, Squirrel Girl's on five. Hired, the third issue of Hired came out this week. And Ant-Man is also on five issues this month. So Ant-Man and Squirrel Girl have finished off their first story arcs this month. So the trade should be along shortly. The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, to give it the full title.
I may check some of those out. I definitely want to check out that Howard the Duck.
Yes.
The others, I will think about it.
Well, Howard, gosh, if I was to rank them.
You going to give it to Ant-Man?
Based on the first like three issues of Ant-Man, I would say yes. The fourth and fifth issues of Ant-Man slipped a little bit for me because it was kind of blatantly do the villain from the movie stuff, even though that villain's been dead for literally 30 years of comics history and we're only bringing him back to life now because he's in the movie territory. That kind of bugged me. After the comic started out so strongly in such a way that it wasn't going to ape the film at all.
Yeah.
That bugged me a little. But Howard's only three issues in as well. Well, I think I would put... Gosh, I don't know, really. The three of them are all great, and each have their own strengths. In many ways, they're all, to some extent or another, sort of spiritual successors to something like Dan Schultz's She-Hulk. You know, something Howard and Squirrel Girl in particular feel like spiritually they're kind of successors to what Dan Schultz was doing on She-Hulk. Squirrel Girl, in particular, specifically out of all of them, because of the way it it's produced in with such loving loving good humor to the history of the Marvel Universe and the way that the worlds of the Marvel Universe were. Like, there's a great scene where they see, like, there's Galactus, and they say, Tippy Toe says, is it true that every race sees Galactus differently as one of their own? And Squirrel Girl says, well, I don't know. And Tippy Toe says, throw me up there. I want to get a good look. So Squirrel Girl tosses Tippy Toe up into the air. Tippy Toe looks down, and there's a giant squirrel wearing Galactus's hat. but then Squirrel Girl catches her and is like, what did you see? I don't know. Same thing you did, I guess. You know, big guy, purple hat, skirt.
That's great. Do you think Squirrel Girl will ever show up in the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
I hope so. I love her.
She'll be a while before the Cinematic Universe, but much like Miss Marvel, which is another excellent book, but Fanboy has received a special about that last year, but it has kept its quality up all through the first year. Marvel are missing a trick lately if they don't put these characters in their terrible cartoons quickly.
Yeah.
Because the cartoons are terrible now, but kids are watching them.
Yeah, I can't watch that Spider-Man or that Avengers, and heck, I don't even know if I've ever even watched that Hulk cartoon.
Don't try it. It's the worst. Yeah. It's the worst one of the three.
I think I saw the first episode of the Hulk cartoon, and I was hoping it would turn out to be fun, but I've heard nobody say anything good about it, so I just didn't watch another one. But and that Spider-Man, I hated that Spider-Man, and I hated that Avengers. I couldn't watch either of them.
But they seem to be really resonating with kids, and putting Ms. Marvel in particular, Kamala, they really, really, really need to get their fingers out. I would be surprised if they weren't planning it already. She needs to get in a cartoon for wider exposure to younger audiences, like fucking yesterday, immediately.
Mm. I still haven't read Ms. Marvel. I need to read that.
It's good.
How many issues is it up to now?
Well, it's just hit the end of its third story arc. So two trades are out, and this would be the end of the third arc, probably. So yeah.
Maybe I can catch that on sale.
Make it about 15 issues, I think, now.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Okay, well, I appear to be losing my voice, so
I think that's maybe a good place to stop.
Yeah, exactly. Is Kilby even out there still?
He just put a thing through the Skype message, and he says, we should do it more often, hint, hint, walks away.
this is what happens when we leave it all this time.
Yeah. He says, keep it going, guys. I had to walk away. When the call ends, the recording will too. This has been fun. And I said, you've been so quiet, but thanks for doing this, Brian. And he's like, we should do this more often, hint, hint. Well, we should come back like once a quarter and talk about comics, you know?
Yeah, just what's been going on. Well, I mean, yeah. We could come back and talk about Ant-Man towards the end of the summer, at least.
Yeah.
Okay, and Fantastic Four.
I don't know if we need to talk about that one.
That's a weird one. That is a weird one.
I don't like the looks of it.
I don't like anything I've heard about it.
Didn't that guy go insane also? I mean, the director?
I don't know.
Because it seems like something's happening with him, because he was going to do a Star Wars movie and something happened with him.
Everyone was going to do a Star Wars movie.
I've heard I've heard he had like a nervous breakdown or something. There's something crazy going on with that Fantastic Four movie.
Well, the first trailer looked like a really generic science fiction movie. But the second trailer sort of it got under my skin on the second trailer. I was like,
I heard Dr. Doom is a blogger.
But there's no evidence of that. I don't like they said that like and now it's like where does that fit into what we're seeing in the trailers?
It looks better in the second trailer. I'll admit that, but it's
there's some moments of levity in there. You can see the powers, they're looking pretty good. I mean, it's clearly an interpretation
of dark though.
It's so dark.
It's so dark. I want color. What's wrong with color, people? What's wrong with color? Come on.
You see, this is the Batman and Robin effect.
Yeah.
Where the last effort to do them went that route, went colors and bright and fun.
Didn't Fox buy another comic property that's a darker property and make that movie? Do Kick-Ass 3, I guess. I don't know. I'm not going to go see it.
That's what I'm saying. It's like whenever Batman and Robin killed superhero films for roughly 10 years, whenever Batman came back, it was in direct opposition, contrast to what the previous Batman film had done. So I really feel that is why they've taken this approach with Fantastic Four, is to stand in opposition to the who made those films? Tim Story films.
Tim Story, yeah. I don't want anyone to like not have a job or anything, but I hope it fails. I just wanted to bomb so that maybe they'll just give it back to Marvel. Just do it.
I'm the same. Like, I really do. It's like the Fantastic Four feel, obviously they're still the X-Men, but in particular, because the X-Men are so off in their own bubble normally in comics anyway, the Fantastic Four, and not Spider-Man anymore now, the Fantastic Four feel like the gap in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, that's like the one thing that's missing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sort of needs to be in there.
Yeah, the X-Men are normally off doing their own thing anyway, so big deal. But
you sort of expect like Ben Grimm to show up at the Avengers Tower every once in a while.
Yeah, or something like
that. Or like the human torch, fly by it. I'd stop and talk, but I got to go save the world from Galactus. Bye.
Yeah, the Annihilation is approaching. Bye-bye. I mean, presumably if they're doing some variant of the Ultimate Origin, then the Negative Zone will be involved in the film too.
It looks like they go to the Negative Zone, their power.
That seems to be what that decim. I mean, that's what the Ultimate story is. So, I mean, if maybe that means if they're feeling brave and they're going to push beyond just Doom and maybe do something a bit more fantastic. Who knows? I mean, this
Fantastic for Fantastic Four.
I know, it is probably important. We are all mispronouncing the title of the film.
What's it called?
It's Fant-Four-Stick.
What? that doesn't fill me with hope. Why don't they call it like Reed v. Doom, Dawn of Fantastic?
Ballistic Reed v. Doom.
Yeah.
I don't know. The director's good, but it just seems like it's taking characters I have a deep and abiding love for off in the wrong direction. But yeah, the second trailer sort of sparked something in me, so we'll see.
I mean, if it's good, I mean, fine. I'll see it. But
it's good.
It's the least thing that coming out this year. I have like the least interest in.
Certainly this year and next year.
Yeah, next year. Yeah.
I don't even think.
No. Next year we have Deadpool.
Oh, I don't know what to think about Deadpool.
I'm excited for Deadpool.
Worried about Deadpool.
I'll probably see it.
But I'm just really worried that it's like, first of all, they've got the R rating.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's an excuse for blood and tits and swearing, isn't it? Lovely.
I hope it's exactly like Mad Max Fury Road, so that when Nicole likes it, we can say, see, that is a great movie.
I probably like Deadpool, not Mad Max.
The version of Deadpool that generally exists in the wider public consciousness, which is, that is to say, outside of the hardcore comic book reading fandom, is the version from video games and out of context panels pasted on 4chan and Tumblr. The weird Bugs Bunny with a death wish, Daniel Way, Deadpool, that loses all of the character's humility and tragic clown and humanity.
But see, Ryan Reynolds has helped him write it, though. He's a huge Deadpool fan.
I like Deadpool as a rule, but I've really come to hate people who like Deadpool.
Okay,
you hate yourself.
It's exactly the same thing as we were talking about people who like Harley Quinn from before the show.
Yeah.
Exactly what it is. A weird, warped version of the character that only truly exists in the minds of people who say they like the character.
Well, but his comics, or his reboot, is doing so well.
Oh, no, yeah. In the New 52, the Marvel The Marvel Now stuff has brought back all of that humanity and on the tragic elements of Deadpool that Joe Kelly worked with that defined and made his run the defining take on the character, which Daniel Way threw out in favor of bullets and talking caption boxes. I don't want that to be because we've seen that version of Harley Quinn is the version that's making it to film, obviously. I mean, I don't have to wait for that film to come out to see that is where the inspiration for that Harley is coming from. Mm-hmm. But I have to hope that I'm so torn up about Deadpool, honestly. And also, I mean, they have to handle it really carefully because we all saw that test footage. And let's be honest, that was fine for 2 minutes. But if that goes on like that for 2 hours...
I don't know how you make a movie.
But I was listening to another show today. They're using a lot of practical... They're trying to use as many practical effects as possible.
That's good, practical effects.
And I was just like, thank you. Let's get back to that Hollywood. And,
you know,
wasn't the teaser all CG though?
It was.
Yeah. Okay.
But see, Ryan Reynolds did that so he could promote it, so they could get the studio to go behind him. That's why he did that.
Yeah.
And the costume looks absolutely fantastic as well. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that it looks amazing. One of the most incredible comic to film translations of a costume ever, I think. I just wish I didn't fear and hate so much what the potential inspiration for the film is, and who the potential audience is that Fox of all people that Fox might be making this movie for. So I'm really, really worried. And
I'm gonna be excited for it. It comes out in February.
Yay. Man, that's early.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but all the way.
But because Batman Superman comes out March.
And doesn't X-Men come out next summer? Is next summer X-Men?
Yeah, X-Men Apocalypse is next year too.
Wow, it's going to be a busy
critical mass.
There's a superhero film like every month for like 7 months or something like that. That's why they had to put Deadpool in February.
17, I think, is the or it's either 2017.
Next year is Doctor Strange too, isn't it?
Yeah, well, next year is Deadpool, Apocalypse, Dawn of Justice, Civil War, and Doctor Strange. I think the year after, or maybe it's 2018, there's is a real critical mass here. Whenever, you know, what's 2017?
Wait, Suicide Squad's supposed to come out next year,
Suicide
too.
Suicide Squad is next year, too. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Is Suicide Squad coming out in 2016? I figured they'd wait longer.
No,
okay.
No.
Wow, okay.
So you have a schedule to keep.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a couple more, and I can't remember what they were announcing. But
I think I want to say it's 2017 or 18. It's the real critical mass year, whenever like an amazing number of things land in a very short space of time. But I can't remember. There's a hell of a lot coming down the pipe anyway, and it can't all be good.
Nope. That's the unfortunate thing.
And it's like Marvel has bucked the trend long enough, you know. They're due a cock up, and I hope it's not Ant-Man. Shut up.
It's not Ant-Man.
No, everyone's like Marvel can do no wrong. I'm like, did we forget Iron Man 3?
Oh yeah,
Iron Man 3 is still better than Iron Man 2.
I like the second one better.
Parts of Iron Man 3 are better than parts of Iron Man 2. But if you combine them, you have the best and the worst movie ever made.
you forget the cult from Fox.
I tell you what, though. Having rewatched Phase 2 recently there before Age of Ultron, I have to say Thor 2 is really right down there at the bottom of the list with those movies as well.
It's not my favorite. I like the first wave.
I like it until Loki leaves, and then it's just like the movie drags on. And that's not just me being a fangirl. That just means it's just like...
I mean,
that
the movie,
last 20 minutes is just like, oh, come on.
No, you're quite right, because the movie only even really begins to come alive at all after they let Loki out of the cell. So it's really only at its best for that stretch from after they let Loki out to after Loki disappears. It's not quite as unfocused as Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
But it's right down there with it, honestly. I think I'd probably put Iron Man 3 above Thor 2.
Really?
I think I'd probably agree with
Iron Man 3 was...
Largely because I'm over the Mandarin thing. The Mandarin thing was my big problem with Iron Man 3.
It wasn't that. It was Tony being a sobbing, woe is me character.
He wasn't, though. His whole point, the whole point was that he really didn't... He refused to be that. So
I could have got my heart fixed back in the first movie, but we did it in this movie. I still hate that.
Like, that's one of my favorite things about Iron Man 3 is the way the kid tries to have a sob story, and Tony's like, "Shut up, you know." My dad went to get cigarettes and didn't come back. Yeah, that happened. Stop being a pussy. Moving on. The kid keeps trying to have like a schlocky stock movie, broken man, lonely kid connection with him, and Tony's just not having it. By the way, I'm going to run you over.
But like, at least Iron Man 3 has like a well kind of rounded villain. Where the problem with Thor was, I'm sorry, but
yeah, no,
that was not a good villain.
The least inspired, like the best villains. I was having this discussion on a forum recently. Is like the best villains in anything are the ones that are some kind of dark reflection of the hero. And I don't necessarily mean the evil twin, because the evil twin is a very hackneyed concept. So whenever I talk about the dark reflection of Spider-Man, I don't necessarily mean Venom. I might mean Dr. Octopus, the young lonely boy who sought refuge in science and who was then transformed.
Oh, I would love to see a superior Spider-Man movie.
Wilson Fisk from Daredevil season 1.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Very good.
A man who grew up in the disenfranchised area of New York, but who learned all the wrong lessons from his father and is now trying to employ those lessons in order to bring order and peace to the place he loves and calls home. You know, stuff like that. We're not so alike, you and I. We're nothing alike. It's like, that's the overriding thing. You know, it's like even with Iron Man, the very first Iron Man, you've got evil industrialist in armor versus good industrialist in armor, the guy who wants to sell out and make weapons versus the guy who won't do it, you know. Or with Thor, it's Thor versus his brother, you know, but it's like it's the son who had the love of his father versus the one who thought that he was never good enough, stuff like that. Or in Captain America, you've got two men transformed by the same serum, one good, one evil. It's just two sides of the same coin. It's just stock stuff, and it's why the Steel Serpent will be such a great villain for Iron Fist. But Malik, this is just some dude who comes in and wants to wreck shit for an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, it just wasn't good.
Just nothing engaging about him. This is, for supervillains in particular, when you want to have these intimate conflicts. And this is the problem with Spider-Man on film, and not to completely digress back a year ago to what we were talking about again.
Yeah. But,
you know, people like Norman Osborn and Dr. Octopus, and Venom's an odd one because they tried to do that evil twin with Venom, but as originally written, Venom is shit. Like, but things like the Ultimate Comics and the Spectacular Spider-Man cartoon try and exploit the trope then and really turn Eddie Brock into Peter Parker's dark opposite, someone who lost his parents but didn't have to teach him right from wrong, and they went off on different paths, and then they became you know, dark opposites of one another. The people like a Norman Osborn, you know, and the Dr. Octopus, people who are changed by science, who use it for their own ends, who don't have the moral center of Peter Parker. But most of Spider-Man's villains are street-level goons. Like, Spider-Man is, like Daredevil, is perfect for a TV series, mm-hmm. where you could fight low-key baddies every week and duff up the shocker and be done with it, and that's it. But Spider-Man will never, ever work on a TV budget, so that's just sad. It's just the sad truth. But it's why it's so difficult to put Spider-Man on film with consistent success.
Well, people are going to love Spider-Man no matter what. They'll go watch Spider-Man no matter what. He's
Spider-Man
a
2
character.
Did not, you know.
Spider-Man, I still liked
2.
It.
Oh, I liked 2, as I said back at the time. I just can't feel anything less than warm to a film that so successfully translates the character on screen. It has massive problems elsewhere, but I rewatched it not that long ago, and I still enjoyed it.
Jamie Foxx didn't get on your nerves? He really gets on my nerves.
He doesn't get on my nerves any more than he did in the first place. I don't understand why he's Dwayne Dibley from Red Dwarf. I don't get why he's a cartoon nerd.
But it's like, what happened to my fantastic, amazing Spider-Man? It's like he's been transported into a Batman movie in the 1990s. What happened?
I don't think that that's necessarily... I mean, once Jamie Foxx stops being Dwayne Dibley, John Glover out of Batman and Robin, once he stops being that, I think his portrayal of Electro is fine.
I never.
It's very one note. And Electro doesn't have the chops to carry a film.
No.
As a bad guy.
I still love Andrew Garfield. Still love Emma Stone.
I adore Andrew Garfield. I'm so sad that he's going.
Yeah, but I hate that.
The idea of hiring an actual teenager to
Costume. Costume looked great in that movie.
My God. I mean, like, hope this is what I'm saying. Please, please, please look at that film, see what worked, and just copy it directly.
Yeah.
Just take it and move it over. Drop what doesn't work for your universe, but please take all the levity, all the lightheartedness, all the good humor, all the inbent tragedy, all the good looks of the costume. Just bring it all over with you.
Yeah.
Okay, we should really wrap this up.
Yeah.
We've only been going for 4 hours.
We've recorded 6 episodes of Fanboy Versus this week.
We had to make up for it, I guess.
Yep.
Oh dear, that's far too long, isn't it?
Yep. It was fun though.
I liked that at the beginning of the show. We're going to talk a half hour about the movie and then 15 minutes on the TV shows.
Okay, but
is it like 1 in the morning your time, McFeely? Is it like?
No, it's just after 11. It's...
Okay.
Holy crap!
I'm sorry.
We did talk for like an hour at the start before we actually started doing the show. So it's not a 4-hour show.
Oh, yeah, I had to get my complaint session in about Mad Max.
Boo.
Boo.
Everybody direct their hate mail towards
Hilton. Oh, we've already got hate mail about it, so bring it. I'm not going to fall for it.
Okay, well, I think we'd better call an end to it at that.
Brian's left the building and yeah.
So we'll probably come back later in the summer to talk about Ant-Man and anything else interesting that's happened then. Perhaps we'll talk a bit about Secret Wars. That'll be well on its way by that stage.
Yeah. Read the first issue. Read so far.
We'll see. And we need to talk about the awesomeness that's still Transformers. It's good stuff.
That's happening. Yeah, but they stole our name and they have a show dedicated to that now.
Yup.
Thieves. Okay,
hey,
right.
I think I'm on that show sometimes. So,
oh well, you can't say anything about it, or they'll kick you off. Okay, well, I think that you're right. So, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Aloha.
This has been Fanboy Versus.